Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Previously on Lost.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
They've attacked us, sabotaged us, abducted us, murdered us. We're not the only people on this island, and we all know it.
So I guess I'm out of the book club.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back.
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 3, Episode 21, Greatest Hits. And my question is, what's your number 5 greatest hit? Not the top, but definitely still on the list. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and when I was 16 or 17, I played a battle of the bands in front of hundreds of people in Denver and threw my arms out during an instrumental to be cheered by everyone. As if I was some sort of God, some sort of Jacob of that stage.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I was trying to go with Charlie's pattern of picking, like, personal is number one, and, like, this is, like, this is the professional slot. So I will say my number five slot is the moment in the Dallas airport after A Con of Thrones, where I decided to create a Slack where all of our listeners could gather and hang out, and thus the Storm Slack was born. So the creation of you all listening, everybody.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I'm also going with my own Charlie Pace moment, in which I sang a lovely duet of Wonderwall with our Slack patron friend Madison Ray at also Con of Thrones. So yeah, high point professionally, and like Charlie Pace himself, I also wrote Wonderwall.
In this universe, you get to claim Wonderwall. Universe. If you're listening to us for the first time, welcome. This podcast is rewatching the ABC series Lost, and it's an ideal companion if you're rewatching Lost with us or just visiting the island for the first time. Each podcast episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, there's a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and this episode's and avoid all spoilers. Those are for a second section that we call The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. This week, we also have an interview. Joanna, who are you talking to this week?
The great Miles McNutt. He was on for our finale sort of retrospective episode, so you guys might have had a taste of him there. But he is a lovely, brilliant person. We'll talk about it. You'll listen to Miles talk about it, but he did a bunch of retrospective watches on the AV Club for Lost that are brilliant, and I've been, like, quoting from liberally, so it's nice to have him here talk about this episode that he requested.
Excellent. If you look down at your podcasting device, you will see time codes for The Calm, The Interview, and The Storm, and you could skip around as your spoilers please you. That sentence makes perfect sense. If you want to support the podcast besides just listening to us, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. There you can subscribe to us monthly and get all sorts of bonus content at different monetary levels. You have extra podcasts. You have access to our Slack that Joanna talked about. You have live watches. We just watched Back to the Future this last weekend. We're also going to watch the finale of Lost next weekend. This finale. We're not just going to skip right to the finale, although I guess we did do that. We're going to watch the season 3 finale with our Patreons in Slack. And you could get in on that at patreon.com/stormofspoilers. One of the bonus podcasts, two of the bonus podcasts that you will be getting, depending on what level you subscribe at, come from Joanna Robinson, who has been producing extra podcast content during these quarantine lockdown times. Joanna, what do you have for us running if they were to subscribe at, say, the lowest level?
Oh, the lowest level. Then you get to hear Kristen Russo of the Buffering podcast and myself discuss some spooky movies. We were just talking about it this morning, which I think we've settled on three. We're going to do a little hybrid. It's one I haven't seen, one she hasn't seen, and one we've both seen, but we just want to enjoy together. So that is something. Also, if you love spooky season and you love spooky movies, there is a whole channel in our Slack group that's just called Witch Please, which is that they resurrect every October-ish to watch. I think they do 31 days of spooky movies. So they just like watch a spooky movie together in the Slack like every day leading up to Halloween. So they're in the midst of it right now. It's great. So check it out. Yeah. And then also I've been having these chats with Dave Chen. We just did one on Time Cop. I just watched Prince of Egypt for the first time the other night with our producer. Ooh. Diana, and Dave has decided he wants to talk to me about that, so we will be discussing the DreamWorks classic, Jesus-y classic, well, no, Moses-y classic, Prince of Egypt, which I had never seen.
Just as a little spoiler, on if you could give it on a scale of 0 to 5 tablets from God.
Do you know what's so interesting in Prince of Egypt? That they make this big deal about Aaron, his brother, who I knew about Aaron because I have read the Bible. But Aaron is like a chiseler. He chisels throughout the movie. And I'm like, isn't the story that like God himself did etch the commandments onto the stone? And I'm like, I feel like Moses just went by to rock and was like, Aaron, chisel me some tablets.
Oh, anyway. Prince of Egypt turned you into the QAnon of the Bible.
I was already there, if I'm being honest with you. All right. So yeah, so you can join us, you know, join the Patreon, listen to those bonus episodes that we're doing. We're also, we have a mailbag this week where if you're part of our Slack, you can submit a question to us, all sorts of fun stuff. I'm really excited about so this Saturday, as Dave mentioned, on October 3rd, we are watching the 2-part season 3 finale of Lost. I know a bunch of our listeners who had fallen behind on the watch are like catching up because they know this is one you don't want to miss the live watch for. Plus, it's my birthday. So everyone could just hang out on my birthday and watch Lost with us in our Slack. So it's fun stuff. You can also get in touch with us some other ways. You can always check our website, stormpodcast.com. You can always check us out on Twitter at stormpodcast. That's where we vote on our Jungle of Kistry poll. We have a little wrinkle on that this week we will talk about. And then you can leave us reviews and you can email us. So let's check in with some reviews and emails real quickly. We're going to start with some reviews. We got a couple new reviews. And this is where I'm vamping because I don't have them pulled up in front of me. There it is. Got it. Oh, no. Aussie accent. Oh, dear. Okay. should I do it?
Lady Fates gives and takes.
All right, I'm going to do it. Because it says Aussie accent in the headline of the review. All right. This is from Flipzilla Kong. And they say five stars, Aussie accent, 5 stars, clear. Oh, no. I apologize, Australia. Love this podcast. I started watching Lost in 2019 after loving the Damon Lindelof Watchmen season on HBO. Loving that, I ran right over and watched the... No, I can't do it. Watched the leftovers on HBO and loved that, which then led me to Lost on Hulu. This might be a good way to jump into Lost. My reason for not watching Lost when it aired might have been just plain ignorance on not knowing that TV could be this good. This podcast is great because, unlike many other spoiler-filled podcasts about Lost, Joanna, Dave, and Neil split the show up perfectly into a front-end non-spoiler section with a clear clickety-clack halftime signal before the back-end spoiler-filled section starts. They go out of their way to make sure they don't spoil anything during the commie sections, all the while making it so funny and entertaining along the way. The three do a great job at mixing in their perspectives on each episode's themes, directing, character developments, and what it means for the overall story up until that episode. I can't wait to finish up Lost with them, and then... Lock voice. Have to go back and re-listen to each pod episode to enjoy all of the spoiler-filled bits. Keep up the great work, and I would love to hear you guys pod about another fave show of mine, Fringe. So, that is from Flipzilla Kong. We have one more. 5 stars. Jenny 3865. I once was lost, and now I'm lost again. I was never a big fan of Game of Thrones, so I actually found Joanna by listening to Decoding Westworld, and then followed her here because Lost is hands down my favorite show of all time. I first watched Lost on my iPod video back in high school, buying the episodes for $1.99 apiece, got totally hooked, and then watched it as it aired up to the series finale when I was in college. Teenage me loves Saeed, Sawyer, and Kate. Now in 2020 quarantine, I've been rewatching Lost, and my roommate, who has never seen it before, is watching it with me. But I'm finding that adult me still loves Sawyer, but also loves Ben, Hurley, and Desmond, and is very frustrated with Jack. We're almost done and halfway through season 6, and I'm so excited to hear how she interprets the finale, she being her roommate. I've always loved it, and I hope she does too. I'm binging this pod, though, my rewatch through my rewatch, and while I do love the insights, theories, and predictions of all the show's mythology, what I really love about the podcast is how the hosts bring humor and lightheartedness to an often too serious show. After all, it's just a TV show, and I love all of the corners. I laughed so hard about the Falling Down Award that I almost fell down. Don't worry, I didn't. It brings some much-needed levity to the smoke monster of a year. Keep up the good work. Thank you, and I'll see you in another life, brother. So, great reviews this week. Thank you guys so much. A Decoding Westworld fan and, like, someone who, I guess, just found us searching iTunes for a Lost podcast. So, that is some new territory. But we did get some emails as well. And actually, one of the emails we got was about our time covering Game of Thrones. And I'm hoping Dave has a good answer here. Crystal wrote in to say that she started listening to our Lost Rewatch podcast. And as she's been a huge Lost fan and had recently rewatched the series prior to the show airing, so the timing was kismet. And she says, I love listening to your show while I paint, and it has become part of my normal routine. I'm writing because, well, there's been a lot more time at home, and I've been rewatching another series to have something on in the background between pods. I recently rewatched Game of Thrones and immediately wanted to get your guys' take on the episodes, only to find the feed only goes back so far, and the most recent episodes start in season 4. I miss catching your original cast of Game of Thrones because I was one of the late ones that ended up binging the whole series the last season. Is there anywhere, any way to listen to your whole pod for Game of Thrones? I would happily pay for this to be available. Please let me know. Dave, what do you got for her?
We started, I believe, on season 4 yeah. as a podcast.
Oh,
correct?
that's right.
So my thing would be
episode 2, I believe.
If you would like, here's what I think would be great for this person is if you want, and it sounds like you have maximum amount of time to do as you please with podcasting, you want to listen to A Cast of Kings with Dave Chen and Joanna Robinson. They do seasons. They do all the preceding seasons. Then at the end of season 3, something big happens in Game of Thrones, and Dave Chen wouldn't let Joanna necessarily talk about how they built through the season to that point, and I got frustrated birthing this podcast in season 4 with some stuff that happens right at the top of season 4 that was also very shocking. So the podcasts kind of go hand in hand, and by the time you get to season 4, you have dueling podcasts of a very tired Joanna Robinson going over Game of Thrones week after week for years.
Yeah, I was tired, but it was worth it. It was really fun. All right, so we have got a couple more emails we're going to hit, and then we're going to hit this episode of Lost. So we got an email, you know, that I thought a lot about how I felt about it, and I wanted to talk about it. So this is from Nicole, and Nicole wrote in about our use of the word genocide, so which we use to describe the mass killing of the Dharma Initiative. So Nicole said, first and foremost, I had serious problem with your repeated use of the word genocide to describe what happened in the flashbacks. From what I understand about the Dharma Initiative, Nicole is a calm listener. From what I understand about the Dharma Initiative, they have come to a previously inhabited island, set up a whole community just for themselves, continue to bring in more and more bodies, have set up deadly and kind of cruel defenses around their area, get in skirmishes with the hostiles slash natives, etc. They are, in every sense of the word, colonists. The others took very drastic actions to rid themselves of these colonizers, but I can't help but balk very heavily at the use of the word genocide to describe this. If the Native Americans had killed every pilgrim that had come to America, destroyed all their settlements, would you really label it as such? I mean, actually, probably, but...
The genocide of the settling of the Americas or some weird shit.
But I'm not disagreeing with the larger point here. Feeling in or knowing that it would eventually be their survival or yours, would you identify such an action as genocide? I understand that it may seem like semantics, but the word is more than a pejorative and leads to my next concern, the assignation of good versus bad people. For many weeks, I've heard you all laud the character of Juliet, who is in a circumstance she could not have foreseen when originally connecting with the others and has been doing her best for as long as we have seen her to get herself out of it. She's done some things that are generally perceived as objectively bad, including lying and keeping secrets and murdering someone. All this is done in the service of getting herself off the island and back home to her family and save Kate and Sawyer in the moment. And you have repeated your belief that she is a good person despite all that she has done. This is entirely different when it comes to the general others, though, especially in this situation slash episode. In your excellent interview with Jacob Stolworthy, it was repeatedly asserted that they committed a terrible crime, the aforementioned genocide, and thus are inherently bad people. I fail to see the difference between the situations, though. They also saw themselves in a situation where they could not have foreseen and did terrible things to get themselves out of it, and yet the assignment of good and bad are completely different. I feel the need to point out that I love your podcast, and I for sure wouldn't be watching Lost if I didn't like you guys and your analysis very much. That being said, I think it would be greatly benefit you to take a look outside of your normal mindset and question why you view things in a certain way. It's something that I've seen time and time again in dominant American thinking, that certain people are given the benefit of sympathy and consideration of intention, while some others are simply not. Again, you may feel this is a big inference for a conversation about a sci-fi television show, but the way we talk about media is reflective of the way we view the world, and taking a second to look outside of your current view of the world and consider larger implications would do wonders. And that's from Nicole. So I feel like mixed on this email. I appreciate that Nicole wrote it. I think she's right that genocide is the incorrect term to use here. But something that we've, I guess the only pushback I would say is that something we have been debating is sort of like, and maybe I've been doing it more in the storm section than in the calm section, but something I feel like I'm like repeatedly coming back to is like, what are we supposed to make of the others? I would like to... I mean, I think the introduction of Juliet is to make us sympathetic to the others and their plight. But then when you get something like, it's hard for me to view what happens with the Dharma Initiative outside the context of like the Losties crashing on the beach, not even knowing that the others exist, not trying to colonize the island, not trying to like infringe on their territory because they don't even know they're there. And Ethan comes and breaks every bone in Scott Steve's bodies anyway. You know what I mean? Like, that there, it isn't just like, you know, the Dharma Initiative shows up with like smallpox blankets and like, you know, fuck them. Like, it's, yes, they are colonizers. I agree with that. I won't push back on that. And yes, they are unwelcome and all this sort of stuff like that. But like, I don't know. It's complicated. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think it's definitely complicated. I think that, like, the readings of, like, good and bad, like, sometimes I feel like the safest thing to do when discussing an episode deeply for us as watchers of television and people who, you know, maybe made something creatively in the past or attempt to, is a lot of the times you'll hear us talk about what the writers intended, or what Damon Carlton, the showrunners, intended, or how production, you know, made something happen. So I think maybe sometime our wrestling about good and bad overall in the show is really on the show's terms. I think occasionally, you know, we do step out, especially with Jack, of the world of the show and say, like, you know, here's why this is maybe looks bad. But in terms of like viewing the actions of Juliet as like good and complicated, that's definitely season three's narrative, and the others is bad or nebulous and killing people. I think labeled bad. Jack wants to blow them all up, just like sight unseen in this episode. So I think it, like at this point, the show we're debating within the show terms.
Well, and I think the show doesn't, you know, because it's not just Juliet, right? We've got Alex and Carl. I don't want to see Richard blown up. I actually quite like Tom Friendly. You know what I mean? Like when Jack says,
"Well, I don't know if we can blow Richard up,"
but like
he just would Wolverine himself back together.
But when Jack's like blow them all to hell, there's like several people on the other side that I don't want to see them blown all to hell. Cindy and the kids, etc. So like, I do think the show does a good job in season three of you know, making that more complicated. And I think In the Man Behind the Curtain is very complicated because, once again, I like Richard and I am empathetic to young Ben. It's just when you see the gassing. I mean, if the Dharma Initiative did that to the others, I would say that's a genocide as well. But like, I'm not going to use that word. That's the same degree of bad mass killing, honestly, even though the others have a original claim to the island. You know what I mean? I think a mass killing in any context, even if your back is up against the wall, is not the way out that I would hope would happen. I don't know. Neil, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, my only counterpoint is, what if everyone is bad? That is a question the show would like us to be. Uh-huh. As Dave said, we're engaging with it on the show's terms for the most part. But the show wants us to be asking that question constantly.
Yeah.
It's like, are these people inherently good? Are they inherently bad? Look at what people are capable of when put in different situations.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, those conversations are going to continue. And, you know, we'll keep trying to navigate them as best we can within the confines of this
show. I think Nicole's right that to say, like, you know, and I think all of this on this podcast, with exception of maybe like Hitler, like when it comes to like massive global conflict or whatever, like none of us are like, yeah, America's right and everyone else is wrong. You know, that's not what this podcast is. That's not who we are as people. And so like, I think that this show is actually very concerned with who is good and who is bad. And then also making that like very complicated in the end. And so I think we'll get there and that'll be a really fun thing to discuss. But I appreciate the perspective from Nicole and a corrective on a word that I probably should not have used. So and then this last email I'm gonna read is from Sean. Who Dave liked this email so much he put it on Twitter. Sean wrote, "Hey there, I'm a long time listener, first time, gonna stop there. I just want to thank you guys for getting me into The Lost the proper way. I've been listening to the pod since Game of Thrones season 6. I was apprehensive about the switch, but thought I would give Lost a chance after hearing you guys hype it up so much, and I regret nothing. The week to week is also so good. Death to this dumb binge culture, and let conversation and speculation blossom again. I'm so tired of doing the binge requirements to avoid spoilers and failing to sit and enjoy the show. Keep up the amazing work and let you never fall down. Sean Gallagher from Chi-Town." So thanks, Sean. And yeah, so those are some emails. We had some other great ones, but I want to get into the episode. So I will keep those on the back burner, but you can always email us hosts@stormpodcast.com. We love hearing from you. And we will see you Saturday for the finale live watch. But before then, Neil, What happened on Lost this week?
Well, this episode that we are about to talk about, it's called Greatest Hits, and it was directed by friend of the pod, an Emmy deserver, Stephen Williams. It was written by, also friends of the pod, Edward Kitsis and Adam Horowitz, and it aired on May 16th, 2007, which by my count was 38 years ago. It takes place on day 90 on the island. In flashbacks, we witness the greatest hits of Charlie's life, from the first time he heard himself on the radio, to learning how to swim, to the first time he met Claire in the aftermath of the Flight 815 crash. Back on the island, Jack finally unveils his plan to fight back against Ben and the others. It involves Rousseau, the dynamite, and some strategically marked tents. While plans are being formulated, Desmond, tells Charlie that he's had another vision. It involves Claire being rescued, but it also means that Charlie really does have to die this time. We'll see how that goes. And just as Jack's plans begin to come together, Carl, remember Carl? Carl shows up to inform the camp that Ben's crew is coming a day early, which means it's time for a new, accelerated plan. Rousseau is going to lead the survivors to the radio tower. Charlie and Desmond are going to swim down to the Looking Glass station and unjam the radio. And a small crew is staying behind to shoot the dynamite. It all ends with Charlie successfully knocking Desmond out in a boat, then swimming down to the Looking Glass only to find a pair of gun-toting Dharma women. Uh-oh. Fun fact, Dexter Stratton, which is the name upon which the drive shaft band name it was taken. This was Charlie and Liam's mother's grandfather.
This is the silliest part of this episode. Yeah.
So Dexter Stratton, the name itself, is actually a combination of two names, Ricky Rick Stratton and Dexter Stuffins, from the 1980s sitcom Silver Spoons.
Funny.
Which I was not aware of previously.
Aware of the sitcom? Or aware of the fun fact?
I didn't know anything. I didn't know that Silver Spoons was a thing.
The only reason I know that Silver Spoons is a thing is because, like, in that same way that I know Leif Garrett was a thing, and, like, I'm not old enough to have lived through it, but I know that, like, Rick Schroeder, who was, like, Ricky Schroeder on Silver Spoons, was, like, a thing before I was born, so I wanted to know why, and it was because Silver Spoon. And I think also Alfonso Ribeiro was on it as well before he was Carlton. Nice. So, Silver Spoons.
Nice. Silver Spoons. All right, this week's opening calm question. In this episode, Charlie at one point, I believe, claims that he can hold his breath for 4 minutes, which is suspect for a lot of reasons that I'm sure we'll discuss. For how long would you estimate that you can hold your breath? And I will start by saying that I tested this a little bit earlier today before we started recording, which I'm sure was a great idea. I very easily got to like 45 seconds. So I'm thinking I could do like a minute and a half if I had to.
That's what I'm saying. Okay. So while you were talking, actually, I held my breath and timed myself.
Oh, wow.
And like earlier when you were recapping the episode.
Where were you when Joanna passed out?
And I got to 45 seconds and I was thinking, okay, but if I know that like if I open my mouth, seawater is going to rush in, I think I could get to a minute and a half. And if I have a weight belt, like maybe that'll get me where I need to go in time, but probably not. Dave, what do you think?
Oh, probably like a little over a minute. I don't think I get to a full minute and a half. Basically because I've, you know, experimented this like with this like all children do in a pool. And I could get a really long time if I'm like super relaxed, like get a full breath of air and just like don't panic. But heading down to a station underwater with a weight belt after knocking Desmond out is a panic situation. So I'm going to say 60 seconds.
Nice. I was also thinking about this earlier because I was thinking about like one of my life goals at the moment is to at some point move into a place that has the best bathroom and a Neil-sized bathtub.
Yes.
And I think if I had access to a Neil-sized bathtub in my life, I could probably practice this and get way up over a minute, you know?
Well,
so,
yeah.
Putting that out into the universe.
Come the like global warming apocalypse where the United States turns into an island of mystery. We will want these skills. So yeah, let's find you that bathtub and get to shape of watering.
Neil's taking the diving, which is good because drowning scares the shit out of me.
I guess so. I'm going to lead the Navy, the post-apocalyptic Navy. Got it.
Yeah. I'm still in the monkey hotel business and business is booming. Hey guys, it's a good Charlie episode.
It's the best Charlie episode.
Oh no, bleep that.
Yeah. It's definitely right. It's definitely the best Charlie episode.
Oh, for sure. It's the Moth, Fire and Water, and Homecoming. And I think the Moth is an okay episode, but Fire and Water is real bad, and Homecoming is not. great. So yeah.
I still like the moth, but not as much as this episode.
No, this episode's so good. It's a great episode. It's outside of it being a Charlie episode, it's just a ridiculously great episode of television, I think. So
it's one of the cool things where it's like it uses the flashback structure in another type of way, and because of that feels like a very special episode of Lost. It's like you're always going to remember like the other 48 days flashes, you know, before your eyes, and now this, because it's not just like it frees you from the burden that I often hold a lot of these episodes to, which is make your flashback tie into the island by just making your flashback dig into a character the way you'd want to dig into any character on like any fictional show. Like the idea of seeing somebody's like five best memories is like a great idea for any character that I love. I would want that to happen on other shows. So the fact that it like executes here gives a real sense of purpose to the flashback and a real sense of character. And it's building to this whole Desmond, Charlie try to outwit fate again. But you know, like that premise is wearing thin on both of them. Just a lot of good climaxing for a lot of setup here.
Can I piggyback off that climax comment? So yeah. This is a list episode, right? So I have several lists for us to like go through here, beyond our usual corners that we do. So this is the first list that I would like us to rank, or maybe just pick your number one. There are several. Emily Vandervoof, when she joined us to talk about the series finale on that episode, she talked about how Lost was so good at act outs. And it's increasingly becoming a Lost art because so many things are built for the streaming model, for the binging model and stuff like that. So you don't get big act breaks, but you do on Lost. And this, I think, not to steal the thunder of a conversation that I had with Miles McNutt about this, but this, I think, is like an all time jam packed act out, act break, go to commercial moments stuff. So I want us to rank, or at least pick our number one. Let's pick our number one of these four act breaks. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna start with probably the weakest, which is Claire saying, "Be careful, Charlie," as he like walks, strides manfully towards the ocean. That's one. "This time you have to die." That's Desmond. Then we go to commercial break, right? And then we've got "We're going to blow them all to hell." That's Jack. Classic Jack act out. And then, not to tip my hand, but this is my favorite. It's our boy Carl going, "They're coming right now." I love when Carl does that. I mean, I talked to Miles about this, but like, there's a long pause and then it's like music. I love that line delivery. Anyway, so do you guys have one that you think is better than Carl's? They're coming right now.
I think Desmond's, "You have to die this time."
This time you have to die.
I actually think that it's funny because you said this one was maybe the least good when you started reading them, but there's these subtle little things that Dominic Monaghan does in this episode.
Yeah.
You know, we talk a lot about good face acting on Lost.
So good.
There are several moments where you're just like, holy shit, like this character, regardless of how you feel about him, is really coming to terms with potential, you know, the idea that he has to die to save Claire, which is, you know, that's what Desmond tells him. And I actually think that the walk away is a really good, like, you know, I guess it's a really, like, it's a sad moment, I guess, if we're not expecting Charlie and Claire to reunite, which Charlie is certainly not. And yeah, just his face throughout this episode is just great. I mean, one of the things about I like about this episode is not just that it's an extremely well-written episode, it's, you know, structured extremely well, but Dominic Monaghan really brings it here, you know, as we're getting to the climax of Charlie's story. And it's great.
Yeah. And it's that walk away from Claire. Okay. So I vote Carl, Dave votes Des, and you vote Claire. And that these are all good choices. Sorry, Jack, you lose again.
I mean, sorry, Jack. I mean,
But you mentioned the walk away to the ocean and Dom's face, and he's so good. But I think my favorite play of emotion across Dominic Monaghan's face is like the Hurley moment. And I think another thing that makes this episode so good is there's the tension. It's not uncommon on Lost. In fact, it's discussed in this episode for information to be withheld from other characters. And it's something that makes Dave crazy in general. But I think the tension of like, Charlie knows what he's about to do, and neither Hurley nor Claire nor Jack nor anyone else knows what he's about to do, except for Desmond. And so there's that double layer of crunchy goodness to the episode because of that, you know?
Yeah. Well, and the audience knows what he's about to do, which
right. The audience, Desmond and Charlie. Just,
like, we're constantly watching everyone around him going, we know
the stakes. We know the stakes of what he believes he's headed towards his death. And then Hurley's like, whatever, see you later. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Crush it.
And then they leave the ring behind.
The stupid ring. It's the only stupid part ring. Of this episode. Because let's just talk about it, right? Let's just get it out there, right? This ring that was clearly designed to be like some sort of dumb drive shaft vanity ring with like super modern font is now, and like a geographic design behind it, is now trying to be sold to us as some sort of like precious family heirloom that was definitely not made in the late 90s, early aughts. And I'm like, guys, you can't.
They didn't design rings to look like that in like 1880 whatever. Listen, or 1700 whatever.
I'm just saying that maybe Dexter Stratton was a very forward thinking fashionista of his time.
He was a time traveler.
I love it. Stupid
Dexter
ring.
Bloody Stratton.
Yeah. Well, I guess we didn't bleep any of that out, so we gave away the fact that Dexter Stratton shows up on the island to reclaim his ring. Stepping out of the presidential time travel machine.
It's the ghost of Dexter Stratton.
Although somebody did mention in our live watch this past week, and I thought this was a good one, that is one of the all-time great Lost trivia night polls. Because you'll see that. I imagine if you saw that pop up on like a trivia thing, like who is the, you know, person who inspired the band name Drive Shaft? Most people would not get that.
Yes.
But you now will have it seared into your memory that it is Dexter Bloody Stratton.
Dexter Bloody Stratton. There's a couple of continuity errors in Charlie's memory, supposedly. So we talked about his swimming. Here's one that could have possibly saved poor Joanna's life. According to Lostpedia, when Jack, Juliet, and Saeed are discussing the dangerous swim down to the Looking Glass, Charlie tells Jack that he was a junior swim champion in Northern England and can hold his breath for 4 minutes. But in White Rabbit, when Joanna is drowning, Charlie yells after Jack, alerting him to the drowning, "I don't swim, I don't swim," though he may have been lying in either instance.
This is my new favorite tinfoil hat theory of Lost, which is that Charlie hated Joanna and actually murdered Joanna. And we're only like Hercule Poirot-ing the pieces together now here in season 3. But I love Charlie in this episode. I support him. I find him very heroic. I'm not going to try to really tarnish his legacy, but I do think he straight up murdered Joanna. That is my new headcanon.
So you think that, so we see in this episode the scene where Charlie and Claire meet for the first time on the beach after the crash.
Yeah.
So maybe Charlie had just walked away from a conversation with Joanna that had gone poorly. Perhaps. Maybe he's just walking around the camp, sitting down, trying to talk to
him. Oh, Joanna saw him, like, rubbing heroin on his gums.
She knows too much. And so he's like,
she's
hey.
Like, I'm Joanna. I know what heroin looks like. And I know you're Charlie from Drive Shaft. And he's like, fuck, my secret's out.
And he's like, Joanna, how about we do a race in the ocean? You know, I'm like, I don't know where that accent came from. I'm like,
Joanna, a fellow Mancunian?
You know, I'm the swimming champion of Manchester. And Joanna's like, bet, let's race, let's do it. And she gets out there, and then he doubles back. And then except he was dry. But let's leave that aside. And then he just stands there and he goes, oh, I don't swim. I don't swim. Someone's defense is that Charlie was on heroin at the time. And I'm like, I guess he could have been like, I know that I'm too high to swim out there right now. I still think he murdered Joanna.
Heroin is a hell of a drug.
That's what I've heard.
But I think like it being one of his top five, you know, best memories ever sort of indicates that he does swim. So I think you might be onto something there, Joanna. Avenge your namesake.
Yeah.
We know the quake of Dave's will never stop over the island, so.
And yet somehow this is still a great Charlie episode, even though
somehow still a great Charlie episode. So we talked about the ring, we talked about, oh, he got to hear himself on the radio, his number five, which is pretty great. But Joanna, that scene was like another list point.
For Charlie's top five?
For your list episode of lists that we get to choose from.
Right. Okay. Sure.
Is it not? Am I doing segues wrong?
No, it's fine. It's fine. I mostly want to talk about Charlie's list in the storm. And then also Miles and I talked about it a lot in the interview. Miles made some really good points. So I can do a list. Sure. Let us bring back an old favorite of the podcast, which is when the podcast started in season one, we used to do the most 2004 thing about XYZ, right? And then we just like the hardcore early aughts fashion faded away as everyone just got muddier and just like started wearing tank tops and jeans. And Shannon died, our fashionista. So like, so we retired that bit, but we're bringing it back for Charlie in this episode. And here are your four candidates to vote on. the use of Wonderwall, which the Pace brothers definitely wrote. So Wonderwall.
It's Storm Cannon.
Yeah. Getting excited to hear your song on the radio. So remember radio? All right. Chunky red highlights in the infamous Dexter Stratton flashbacks. Charlie wakes up with two groupies and some truly hideous red chunky highlights. And I can say that because I had those exact same highlights my freshman year of college. I achieved them by like one of those, like, I don't know if you guys have ever seen this, but like one bad way to do highlights is they sell these like plastic cap kits with holes in them, and then you say like sort of crochet hook your hair through the holes. Ooh, and wow. apply the dye. It's very like, a lot of people do it when they don't know what they're doing, which is definitely was me at 18 in college or whatever. I had those terrible red chunky highlights. They were all the rage at the time, so that exact same color. So Charlie's awful red chunky highlights that Joanna had in college. And then Charlie's skinny scarf. I don't know if you noticed this, but while he was singing Wonderwall and then rescuing Nadia, he's wearing, it was just like, it was such an early odds thing, those fucking skinny scarves that serve no actual, like, Charlie, you're singing in the rain. Get yourself a large fluffy muffler and not this stupid skinny fashion scarf that doesn't do anything. All right. So Neil, your pick. Is it Wonderwall? Getting excited to hear your song on the radio? Red chunky highlights or a skinny scarf in the rain? What do you think?
Well, I think maybe
it's And Dave?
I'm going to go with getting excited to hear your song on the radio.
All right. And I got to go with chunky highlights, obviously. Team chunky highlights. So that's that is where we are. So that's the most... I mean, you guys can, listening at home, can let us know what you think the most early us thing is about Charlie's little tour through his own personal history here is.
And then, his other items on his list is he gets called a hero and then he meets Claire and it's all fantastic. And I hear Miles covers it later in the interview. So let's talk about Jack's plan, which we've been putting off for two episodes with scenes that make Jack look like an idiot. So it's always like, I can't tell Kate, or I didn't have a plan yet. And now we finally get it. The plan, his plan, was for Danielle to get a whole bunch of dynamite and move it to the tents so that when they came to take the pregnant woman, he would instead blow them up, which is a fine. A plan, I guess. Sure. Just blow them up. Fine. But then, mere minutes after we learn this is the plan, Carl shows up. And they don't have time to pull off the plan. So Jack is forced to riff another plan that includes now sharpshooters.
Point of order. Saeed is the one.
Saeed.
Who comes up with that plan?
Because he's very good.
And also,
he just lets Jack think that that's his plan.
Jack, like, literally refers to it as his plan, and I'm like,
yeah. Saeed's like, I'm gonna let you have that one.
Yeah, Saeed's like, you want to be the big leader? Lead. Go ahead and lead these folks to the radio tower. But I really think that Saeed was like, you need to be the leader. Go act like it. Go lead. Because he was like, I don't want Jack to annoy me on this mission. That's right. What I would do. I'd be like,
I need you away from here so
buddy.
That we can actually do this.
Yeah. So that I can be in charge.
Sharpshoot correctly.
So I can be in charge of what we need to do here. Jack, can you go? Thanks so much.
So what ultimately... Jack, I don't think, really accomplished much outside of convincing Danielle to move a whole bunch of dynamite. But, you know, good enough plan.
He convinces everybody to lay off Juliet, I guess, for a little while with his... You know, Juliet confided in me. I knew all along. Which, still not good enough in my mind.
Yeah, well, we talked about that because it's like, he didn't know all along. He knew after she ultrasound son.
To Charlie's point, Jack did play football with the others, which
yes,
still kind of a problem from a morale standpoint.
Yeah, I think I'm confused about what message the show wants me to have about Jack at this point, because it's sort of, he is now stepping up into a leadership position, but everybody is making good points about him not going about it the right way. And in this episode, he's like, well, you've been waiting for me to make decisions. Now I've made decisions. And it's like, man, you just chose the wrong point to make that point, the wrong time to make that point. Because your decision was blow everything up, which was John Locke's hatch decision.
The only one who thinks that Jack is better since he came back is Rose.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Hey, we saw Rose and Bernard for the first time.
Rose and Bernard, they're back.
This season. Or we haven't seen Bernard all season, right? I think we've seen Rose, but we haven't seen Bernard all season. And it's like he was never gone, honestly.
Yeah, now he's putting his life in danger. So that's usually a good sign for your character if you come back. And you're like, oh, cool. Now I'm part of the most dangerous part of the mission, and everyone's worried that I'm not going to make it. Cool, 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 cool.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about this a little bit more in the storm, but, like, Husbands on the Beach is a really smart narrative move, right?
Mm-hmm.
The husbands Jin, on the beach. And
right,
and
it's Jin,
and
Bernard, and...
Jim, and the world's husband, Saeed.
Right. Yes.
The world's
everyone,
husband.
The audience's husband.
Yeah.
Because he's so good.
Uh-huh. Saeed, Jin... No, but You've got Rose and Sun hiking off the beach, and you've got Bernard and Jin on the beach, which brings like a lot of tension there. And then you've got, if you want to talk about pseudo husbands, you've got Charlie out in a boat and Claire, you know, and I guess his other life partner Hurley on shore. You know what I mean? So you've got these like,
well, you got Desmond in danger, not being able to get back to Penny.
Des in danger, yeah. But anyway, it's such a good... People talk about... Oh, I think I'm about to crib this from Miles, and I apologize. But, like, people talk about table setting as if it's, like, a bad thing. But, like, this is a masterful... In addition to all the stuff that's going on with Charlie, it's a masterful table setting for a finale, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, table setting and paying things off. Right, Joanna?
Okay, yes, I am ready for your transitions now. So we're going to talk about this a little bit more next week when we get to the finale, because there's some even more satisfying stuff there. But there's some fun, like, seed-planted payoffs in this episode. I'm going to give you four candidates, if you will, and you get to pick. Number one, we've got, what did Rousseau need that dynamite for? That's one. That's from a couple episodes ago. We've got, where does the cable going into the water lead?
that's season one.
Mm-hmm. Will these plans that Saeed got from Mikhail ever truly pay off? Yes. He has a blueprint to the underwater station. And lastly, but never leastly, Charlie Sharpie, which we saw in the pilot. Charlie was drawing fate and late on tape on his hands. And the Sharpie hath returned for the greatest hits list. So
the heroin addiction is gone. The Sharpie remains.
The Sharpie remains.
The Sharpie is still flowing. The ink's still flowing in that Sharpie. So, Neil, is it Rousseau and the dynamite? Is it the cable underwater? Is it Saeed's plans that he took from my boyfriend Mikhail? Or is it Charlie and the Sharpie?
I mean, I think Rousseau and the Dynamite's a fun one, especially because it just happened and was extremely weird and mysterious at the time that she just shows up to take dynamite. But I really think that the one I'm most impressed with is the cable in the water.
Yeah.
Because when they put that into that episode, that's what, fourth, fifth episode of season one, where Saeed goes off on his own after torturing Sawyer. And to just be able to track that all the way to the end of season three and make that, and can they continue to bring it up, you know, like we saw it in the episode where they found Naomi, but they still never really acknowledged where it was going.
They never went the other way.
I just remember being obsessed with that cable for like seasons. I'd be like, where does that cable go? And the Looking Glass, like, now that we're at the Looking Glass, I can say that is the most fun answer. It's like, oh, it runs to an underground station where there are more new characters to meet and dangers to experience. It's so great.
A very Damon Lindelof solution, right? What's at the end of this mystery? It's people. It's two lady
Desmonds.
Two lesbians on the sea. I'm sorry, they're canon lesbians to me. You will not change my mind. Dave, what do you think is the most satisfying payoff of this episode?
I like the cable, but the man in me that knows that John Locke is dying on a magical healing island, and now there are two hatches he could blow up, makes me think I'm going to vote for Saeed Blueprints.
All right, Saeed Blueprints. Yeah, I think I'm going to go with Rousseau. That was just really fun. And like, what's just fun, I mean, it makes the whole thing feel planned when you pull up stuff like the Sharpie or the cable and stuff like that. That makes the whole series feel planned. But what will become even more evident in the finale next week is like how actually very well constructed the back end of season three is in terms of all the things that they've put into place to get us here. You know what I mean? There's like good use of Carl in this episode. There's like, you know, there's just like a lot of stuff that feels really satisfying. And, you know, when Lost gets accused a lot of like making up as they went along. But like at the very least, they recovered, you know, to take Damon Lindelof's own words from his Emmys acceptance speech when he was like, you know, stop worrying about being canceled and think about how you're going to get yourself renewed. That's what I feel like the attitude was coming off of like the bad stretch of the beginning of season three. They're like, okay. Well, we did that. How do we come back from that? And they, you know, they nail it at the end here. So there you go.
Yeah, I like having Carl and Alex come back and giving us a beat for Alex to finally voice out loud that maybe Ben is not her father, which I think some of our commies had started wondering after all the early season three, just like, a non-assumptions that, you know, maybe Alex was somehow like a product of Ben and Danielle. Now that we've learned more about Ben, that seems like less likely of a thing that I want to happen. So I'm happy that now the show is letting Alex step out of her father's shadow, even though she probably thinks, you know, well, no, she did. She got John Locke shot because that gun going on the journey didn't work out. But maybe that was a little kick that she needed.
That's not her fault, man. And she's a no he's shot. I mean, like, Ben certainly intimated.
Well, he's like, she had an accident. Here's her gun back.
Yeah.
That seems like
classic Ben.
Very nonchalant way.
He's so great. Yeah.
To quash your daughter's power play.
I do like that when Ben gets back, Richard appears confused. You would think at this point, after his very long life and experiences with Ben, that Richard knows exactly what Ben means.
Well, and also when Ben is like, this is the first time that we know that Ben is lying as he delivers Jacob's orders to Richard. He's like, Jacob wants the raid to happen right now. Right the fuck now. Get up, Tom. Hey, Ryan, person who's definitely been a total character before now, go to the beach. But like, you know,
Ryan and the Meathead Brigade are off to go get him.
Plus Tom.
plus Tom, who we hope doesn't get blown up.
But, like, yeah. Do you, right? I mean, we agree that like this is the this is, we know that Ben is lying to Richard, and that's just like that. This is a question I've been asking maybe more in the storm, but it's just like, why does Richard believe Ben when Ben is like, this is what Jacob wants? Why does he believe him? He's lying. He doesn't talk to Jacob. We found out last week. Yeah. So
come on, Richard, assert yourself here, man. You're ageless.
You've been around the block a few times. This is not your first rodeo.
All right, I think that means it's time for some corners. Our jungle of mystery moment this week is there are two girls in that underwater station.
Yay! If you're wondering why those Dharma lesbians, and I'm just going to call them that, are they Dharma? Are they others? It's all semantics to me at this point. Lana, I think it's Lana Padilla, I think is the actress's name, who plays the dark-haired woman. And she went on to star in Once Upon a Time that Eddie Kitsis and Adam Horowitz did after. She was like the evil queen. She was like the best part of that like kind of trash fire show. So she's a big fan favorite. And then the blonde actress, you might know, Kristen Russo was asking me why she knew her, because I definitely sent a photo of them to Kristen and was like, are these ladies gay? Kristen's like, why do I know the blonde? And we figured out that she's in the pilot of Angel, and I also think she's in the like the opening credits of Angel. So it's like one of those like opening credits faces that you become really familiar with because you see it week after week. So two mysterious ladies under the
down water. In the station, armed, underwater.
My theory was that whoever sent them there, do you guys see those headlines where they were talking about sending like an all-female mission into space because right. they didn't want anyone having sex with each other? And a bunch of people were like, who's going to tell them?
Great job, Space Force.
So I feel like, I mean, like maybe their actual concern is pregnancy, and in that case they would be fine, but someone was like, I was like, do you think whoever assigned these two women were like, well, we don't want any fucking hanky-panky happening under the water, let's send these two ladies? And I'm like, well, I'm pretty sure all they do down there is underwater fucking.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I mean, what you know what they're not doing there, yeah.
The look they're giving Charlie is not, oh, we were hoping for someone to show up.
Exactly.
It's like, you interrupted us.
We're going to shoot you now.
Mm-hmm.
So there, and if they're Dharma, they're not in a pit as a corpse. And if they're others, they're not hiking through the nothing because you had to abandon your suburb. So they're sitting pretty as far as habitation goes.
I mean, despite the fact that they have to be underwater, which it doesn't look like they're very far underwater at this point in that station, that seems like the second best job behind whatever Mikhail was doing. In
I was gonna
cabin.
Say, I was like, I, if you were said first, I was gonna be like, Mikhail in his cabin right. with so his cow.
If we're talking about post purge,
yeah,
jobs
assignment, yeah,
assignments, yeah, yeah. definitely yeah. Mikhail number one,
yeah, number one flame,
and then the looking, glass, two looking glass seems like an easy number two.
I agree with that. I mean, maybe there's jobs around the suburbs that, you know, we might have preferred. Juliet's lab job seems fairly cushy despite her, like, you know, not being allowed to go home.
I mean, they definitely need a plumber because Ethan's their surgeon plumber, which is like not a combination that you want handling you the
wanna,
same jobs.
You don't
want
to use those deft surgeon fingers on pipes. Come on, man. Anyway.
And you don't want anything from plumbing brought into a surgery. No. It seems like two things to not overlap. Our Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award this week is just a vertical distance award. It's going to go to Charlie because sinking's falling down, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just to falling down.
And for his shoe, which seems to be falling up.
And for his shoe.
Iconic shot.
Mm-hmm. Joanna, it looks like we have an accent corner this week.
Yep. Don't worry. I'm getting rid of it so that Neil doesn't get stressed.
We have a accent corner in giant font.
I got rid of it. I'm fixing it. Anyway.
Is it Jump Charlie?
Yeah, it's Charlie. Charlie, don't be afraid, Charlie. Jump. John Henry Canavan, who plays Charlie's dad. I don't think it's the same person who played Charlie's dad in an earlier episode. The Butcher. So yeah, how's his Mancunian accent to your ears, Dave? What do you think? Charlie.
Not from Manchester.
Jump in the water, Charlie.
I'm gonna say from the United States.
Okay.
I mean, oh God, if that's a real accent from Manchester, that's so tough. It's such a tough one. I'm going to say Australian.
He is not American. He is not Australian. He is not Mancunian. He is Toroncunian. He's a Toronto person. He's Canadian. It's a Canadian. It's a Canuck. Yeah, that is not a native to Manchester accent.
That's up there with the Beans Lady.
What's so funny,
worst accents on the show.
There's some things he gets right, because like that sound at the end of Charlie is kind of that like weird gurgling that is kind of right. Charlie, or like whatever. No, don't take that last chick. Don't. Some of it's right. It's just his vowels are it's bad. It's bad overall. Some things are right. Some things are really bad. So no.
Nice try, guy. You were almost replacing the billion beans, which is never a good accent corner.
Four billion beans.
So many. Why would you guess the numbers? Why would you guess the numbers in a bean contest? All right, Desmond Button Corner. We're still at DesCon 4, although the situation seems to be more dire because I think he would have taken his shirt off if he actually would have. He takes his shoes off. To go in.
He was so almost about to take his whole shirt off.
Exactly.
But still no one is taking their jeans off. Still.
Correct.
No one is taking their jeans off when they swim. Why?
Yeah, because that is. Because
it's ABC.
Charlie could swim down in some freaking boxer briefs.
Well, Charlie was told very specifically it was all about weight, so I could see Charlie in this maybe. Particular case, but it doesn't forgive Sawyer Gene swimming or anything like that, or Desmond if he were to not remove his pants. I think it's ABC. The Henry Gale Memorial, obviously a lie award, goes to Charlie, who tries to pull a Lassie on Hurley because you're too big. You won't fit in the boat.
Is that something that they did on Lassie? I mean, this is very Arya and Nymeria, but did they do that on Lassie where it was like, I feel like Timmy
go
was
home,
like,
Lassie.
Go away, Lassie. No. Timmy would say, go home, Lassie, if he was down the freaking well. And he's like, get me some effing help, Lassie.
No, that's something else. But like, go home, Lassie, because you don't want the dog following you into a dangerous situation, I think is a Lassie thing. But because obviously, yeah, that's the reference I made. I really hope it is now. Otherwise, my joke is not funny.
Yeah. Your joke's so funny. I mean, like, it's the illusion I get. Like, Nightmare, I feel like there's other dog stuff where that happens. It's not just Nymeria and Arya. That's the first thing that I thought of.
Well, there's definitely a Harry and the Hendersons reference I could make if I wasn't going to make a Lassie reference, but yeah. The leave because it's good for you trope is what I was referencing, because it's obviously a lie. Hurley could fit in the boat.
It is a very narrow boat.
Fit a whole ass passed out Desmond.
But Charlie is like very narrow hobbit hips, and like he is just barely like squeezed in there. So you know, and it's a two person boat. Like there, it's obviously a lie. Like that's why he's saying it is not for that reason. But also, I was like looking, and I was like, I also think maybe Hurley would not have helped in that situation.
Fair. I guess we haven't seen Hurley like on a boat.
I feel like I'm allowed to say that.
All right, it is time for our Jungle of Kistery. It's where we decide where we want more romance on this show. It's our shipping corner. Joanna, how are we playing it this week? I think we're in a dual episode in a little bit.
Well, it actually went up. The poll went up like sort of right when we started recording, so there actually are already some results. It's not done yet. Our Kistery poll went up a little late this week, and that is fine. But so I will read you what's happening so far. So our Jungle of Kistery poll, because there is a clearish winner, though there could be a comeback because there's 22 hours left for this poll. So our nominees last week for people we wanted to kiss or did kiss or whatever our definition of Kistery is, So coming in dead last is Ben and Rabbits and Dramatic Field Trips. That's just hard to put into poll form, so I understand why that's not going very well. I did want to say that I feel like Jack took like messy bitch reveal lessons from Ben this week when he's like, let me make you hike out into a field so Danielle can blow up a tree. Or I could just say, hey, we've got some dynamite.
No. We got to go on a hike.
Yeah, let's waste several hours of planning and prep time.
Yeah, to go hike into a field so Danielle can blow up a tree. Okay, anyway. So that's so Ben and Bunnies and Field Trips coming in dead last, 7% of the vote. Second to last, Richard and Moisturizer, 25% of the vote.
Boo. I know. That's a good one.
I really
inanimate objects.
Sawyer, Saeed, and Hating Jack, 32% of the vote. But at the top of the charts, top of the pops this week for Man Behind the Curtain, it's Locke and Ben, 36% of the vote. So
yeah, that feels accurate.
I can't argue with it.
In Locke and Ben in the cabin, or Locke and Ben like in the pit full of dead bodies?
Locke and Ben right after like the Who's on First it. About what Jacob says. He's like, help me. He's help like, me. No, what did Jacob say to you? Oh, he said, help me. And then Ben just leaps on top of Locke.
Locke's
and
just like, well, that's out. Just an empty chair. We could make out in that.
Yeah, I like that too. Do you really see someone in that chair? Because if not, we could make out in it.
That's some real Dharma Ladies Under the Sea energy right there. I'm here for it. All right. Speaking of which, this week, we have it is all people on people action this week because we have a lot of tender goodbyes or moments.
The Sharpie go. And the ring both weep. Snubbed.
As we go off on our various quests. So we've got Carl and Alex, our teen lovers.
Youth.
Ah, youth.
And she's all bloody from killing that rabbit.
Just... And I love how Carl's just like her little boy toy tucked in the secret boy toy tucked in the woods. Mm-hmm. Love Carl. He's such a good boy. All right. Claire and Charlie. Obviously.
Charlie
and Claire, as toxic as they have been, we get two really sweet moments of them this week.
I guess Claire has forgiven him for stealing the baby.
Yep. The don't worry about me when you're gone.
Whichever Aaron baby was on rotation gets a smile single shot this episode.
And you're warming for two. Well, that's a good pickup line. Aww. Good job, Charlie. Mm-hmm. All right. So Charlie and Claire. Rose and Bernard, the triumphant return. Love this. This is a good smart thing that they do in this episode is they give us a Rose and Bernard scene and a Sun and Jin scene before we know that Bernard and Jin are going to be left on the beach. So they get little moments. Sun and Jin don't get a real goodbye. They get like a middle distance shot of like, I guess Jin saying goodbye, but they already had the like conversation about the baby moment. And Rose and Bernard had that great, like, knot tying moment before the, like, shooting and the let's get you into something darker. It was great. Rose and Bernard, great in this episode. Chef's kiss.
Yeah, Rose is the only one concerned with people wearing the appropriate pants.
So Carl and Alex, Rose and Bernard, Claire and Charlie, and of course, last but never least in my book, as the Dharma Lesbians Under the Sea.
Doing whatever it is Charlie interrupted.
Uh-huh. We know their names, we're just not, Neil's not letting me say them yet.
Well I think we know factually they are jamming. So they are jamming down there under the sea.
Is that what they're calling it these days?
We are going to learn their names, though.
Yeah,
next
week. But yeah. So Carl and Alex, Rose and Bernard, Claire and Charlie are the Dharma Lesbians Under the Sea, are your Jungle of History nominees. And you can also still whip the votes for Richard and Moisturizer over on the current poll if you want to. So that's Kistery, baby.
Our Where's Libby corner is dedicated to Libby, who left us too soon. So we like to picture her living her fullest life in everybody's flashbacks, like how she appeared in Hurley's flashback. Well, that wasn't her fullest life, but she was there. This time, we have decided she's listening to Charlie Busk Wonderwall, which Driveshaft totally wrote, and, having a great time. And then rushing out of the rain, probably into a very cute coffee shop with pictures of boats on the wall or something. It's now time for our official podcast check-in. While Lost was running, the showrunners, David Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, were doing a companion podcast For the tail end of season three, this is their last season three podcast. We will not have an official podcast check-in next week, but that's okay because we have two episodes of Lost to cover. I will be reading the part of Carlton Cuse, and Neil will be Damon Lindelof. This little section has some answers about old clickety-clack. Here we go. This is actually good. Cerebus is a New York City taxicab by Aaron Robin 29. Two posts in the last 90 days.
This Sorry. Is going to be a doozy.
I thought you said Arian Robin, and I was like really worried where this is going. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I had to go back and correct myself, said Carlton Cuse. Yes, it is true. I was walking to lunch the other day, today like any other day, when I freaked out right there on the sidewalk because I thought the lost monster had somehow found its way to Manhattan. I looked around wildly for the source of that clickety-clickety-clack, flash-a-flash-a-flash-a sound that always signals the arrival of Cerebus. When it hit me, that exact sound the receipt machines in a New York City yellow cab makes, there is no denying it. Just listen to one. Whether or not Cerebus is in fact a yellow cab that's taken on Shaman Island powers after being sucked into the South Pacific by magnetism or whatnot, the sound effects team on Lost is surely incorporating this receipt machinery. Don't try and deny it, Carlmon.
Wow, I like that better than Darlton.
The monster is a taxi. Confess. Good day.
Wow, I like the sign out there at the end.
Well, in fact, you are correct.
We will confess.
That sound, we did borrow that, and it was really the genius of Brian Burke, who oversees our sound mixing, and we were sort of searching for a really cool, unique sound to play with that monster, and he had the idea of using a taxicab receipt, and we actually sent one of our sound guys out in a cab to record it out of a real cab in Manhattan.
And yeah, it has to be the New York City cab, which is...
Yeah, and it doesn't, you know, the fact that this is recording from a New York City cab doesn't have anything to do with the mythology of Smokey himself. Oh, look, there goes Nick Cage's trailer. Bye-bye. Nick Cage has a very big trailer.
Yes.
And it takes like 5 minutes to drive past our window because they're moving out.
And his gym. It's time for another installment of What We See Out the Window While We're Doing Our Podcasts.
And scene. Answers about the smoke monster, interrupted by Nick Cage's trailer, which, like, all the best things, you're going to be interrupted.
So Nick Cage's trailer was driving by their office. Okay.
Yeah, and then immediately after the trailer was another truck that it contains his mobile gym, which apparently he has on set.
Everyone knows that Nick Cage is who they hired to play time-traveling Dexter Stratton, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Who's
spoilers.
Actually the one who brought the receipt machine to the island originally.
Right. Correct.
That then Correct. Became the old clickety-clickety-clack. What does he say?
The old clickety-clack.
Clickety-clickety-clack, flash-a-flash-a-flash-a.
Excellent. Joanna... Who are we talking to this week?
Oh, my God. I already mentioned him 90 times already. I apologize. The great Miles McNutt is here. So we had a nice long conversation about this episode. Miles is so smart about this stuff. It was a pleasure to listen to him. And then we also had a pretty lengthy spoiler chat, which will be released as a bonus podcast later this week up for our Patreon subscribers. So here is a spoiler-free conversation of greatest hits with Miles McNutt.
Today's podcast is brought to you by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? Oh, you know, I'm supposed to insert my personal experience here, but I feel like all of you have very
Points
similar personal experiences.
Everything.
Yeah, just like everything behind me. Joanna's state is on fire. Parts of my state are on fire. I have this cool thing now where I get to check an app about whether or not it's safe to breathe my air outside,
yeah.
Which I'm, you know.
Purple air.
Yeah. If you guys are also in our purple air doomsday device or somewhere else in the world where it's just a normal pandemic, BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. That's right. You can start communicating in under 48 hours because you might need help now. Although it's not a crisis line and it's not self-help, it's just professional counseling done securely online. There's a broad range of expertise available, which may not be locally available in many areas. So that's why this service is available for clients worldwide.
You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor, and you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy, or as in the previous way the world worked, where you could actually be around people. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available because BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today.
My favorite thing about BetterHelp, when you're trying to find someone to help you out, it can be tough to know who might be a good match. BetterHelp has amassed all these reviews of various professionals online, so you can hear what other people are saying about them. Like this review, which sort of blew my hair back. Dr. Okun, this is about Dr. Suzanne Okun. Dr. Okun's wisdom, expertise have been absolutely invaluable to me. Going through a divorce during a pandemic seemed next to impossible until I started seeing Dr. Okun. I lacked the confidence to ask for the things I needed to be fulfilled, and I've lived with massive guilt for as long as I can remember. Now I'm discovering so much about myself, what makes me happy, and how to let go of things which no longer serve me, including that guilt. She's one of the very few people in my life who have truly made me feel heard and seen. I would without a doubt recommend her services to anyone. So, I mean, yeah, who knows what you're going through? There's someone on here that can help you. If you go to betterhelp.com/storm, that's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, and join the over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp, no surprise to me, that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. Special offer for our podcast listeners, you get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/storm. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/storm. Get the help you deserve. We are thrilled to welcome back to the podcast media scholar and professor Miles McNutt. You can find some of his lost writings over on the AV Club or his own blog, Cultural Learnings. He's a brilliant genius, and he definitely requested this Charlie episode.
I did.
Miles McNutt, hello.
That is an accurate thing that I did, in fact, in this circumstance. Yes, I very much recall doing that. Thank you. I'm excited to be here and excited to talk about the mess of Charlie, which I feel like I'll start statement wise because I love statements, but like I feel like Charlie is maybe the character with the biggest gulf between like a rewatch and a first watch sort of experience.
Yeah.
And for that reason, I think it's a fascinating case study to get into.
I completely agree with you. That has been our experience as well, though. Like Jack is having a real hard time with it with our listeners this watch through. So, but Charlie is the one I think everyone can agree on that it's just like, oh my goodness. Before we get into Charlie as a character, I want to start in the most internet way possible. I know you and I are both familiar with internet comments. Are you ready?
Ooh, yes.
I would like to invalidate Charlie Pace's greatest hits list because I'm mad. I'm gonna say I have a quibble. It's not invalidated, obviously. That's just my best impression of a bad commenter. I have an objection that Charlie getting the piano from his mom is not on his top five list. And I know it's a memory we've already seen, so there's no way it could, like, they're not going to do it again. And I kind of know why everything is there, though I think we could have, like, skipped Wonderwall and Naomi and stuff like that. But, like, Nadia. But, like, I know that his memory of his dad at the pool is there so that later he can, like, claim he can hold his breath in the water or whatever. But, right? Like, his mom's not on his list. And like, his mom was the good parent. What do you think?
I would tend to agree with that. I mean, I think the best way to think about this, too, is sort of just a reminder of that, like, the structure of these episodes is never entirely built to be perfectly logical. And I think that this is one of those few cases where, like, we're seeing flashbacks as explicit memories. And not as sort of just vague,
yeah,
like presumptions of, oh, well, this is, you know, kind of a thing they're thinking about right now that they might be kind of moving through. This is like a specific memory that he's having. And so to me, I guess my argument in that circumstance would be that if he had like ample time to like map this out and start comparing and contrasting memories and sort of like doing an objective list to figure that out, it would sort of play out in that circumstance. But I feel like maybe the argument would be that because it was the bad parent, he focused on a good moment with him, that stood out more in this moment, where it's like the idea of having that with him is sort of like a moment that he holds on to, because there was lots of great moments with his mom, piano included, but there was maybe only that one good moment with his dad, which is why it stood out.
I love that defense.
Now I'm that person.
I love
now
it.
I'm that
also,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I love the idea that Charlie Bass is someone who's like, whose editor was like, oh, I need this in 20 minutes. And Charlie's like, all right, I'll bang it out. And he turns it in and then he goes, no, I forgot my mom. And everyone in the comms is going to blast me for it. Perhaps I've just made too many internet lists in my life.
No, that's a very relatable circumstance. No, I mean, I think too is like the dynamic of that. Now I feel like I'm what I do in internet comments, where somebody says something really incendiary and then I step in, I'm just like, I hear what you're saying a little bit, but like, let's maybe see if we can like work through that, which I realized very quickly was very much a byproduct of my teaching experience, where it's like that professor part comes in, where it's just like, people will make these certain comments and circumstances, and I'm just like, that's super interesting, I like where you're going here, let's see if we can't like walk this into a more productive space than where you currently are. And trying to do that to internet commenters is a truly dumb thing to do, and yet I've committed my life to it, and so I feel like it's only fitting that we've kind of managed that accordingly. But no, I feel we've worked that out. I feel like, yeah, I think from my perspective, what Charlie has here is, like, he's just sort of writing it down. He's doing it under a point of stress, under a difficult period. And I feel like what he's going to are, I am ultimately, like, so forgiving of a lot of what Charlie's kind of going through and figuring out and moving through. But there's no question, I feel like if he had more time, I think this would have been a different list. And I think that's true of anybody who's on a deadline, as you say.
Let me zoom back and say, ask you about this series that you did with Noel Murray over on the AV Club, where you guys rewatched all of Lost and wrote these little essays. Oftentimes, they're like two episodes per article. I think there's a few where it's like a standalone episode. What was the impetus for that, and what was your process for that? I know folks listening to this have heard me cite them before. I find them so useful. So talk to me about that rewatch.
Yeah, so this is something that actually Emily Vandeworth had started for the AV Club right before she left the site. And so I look at it in many ways as a very meaningful project for me in my time for the AV Club, because I got to take it over from Emily, who was my mentor and who was such an important presence in that site as it was getting established. And then I got to be joined by Noel at the end, because what happened was the whole premise of this project, of the TV Club Classic feature, was that with some shows, like, you go back to the beginning and rewatch them. But with Lost, the AV Club's TV Club section started only during season 4. So seasons 1 through 3 were never covered by the site. And so the logic was, let's go back and complete the set, as it were. So there would be a review of every episode on the site during that period. And so Emily had started this and then left the site. And then I took over. And that was incredibly fun for me. And Emily and I have very similar kind of styles. I learned a lot from her, and ultimately we're kind of came up in the same group. And so when I took that over, I was sort of diving in, writing these long reviews, sometimes focusing on episode, but mostly doing two at a time. But when I get to season 3, I'm like, okay, we're now meeting up with the reviews that Noel had written. It seems wrong not to have Noel's perspective on this. And so I made this big pitch to the site where I'm like, look, I could just write these like I've been writing them, but this season feels really important. There's some really big episodes in here. It seems like a really pivotal turning point for the show and for a lot of reasons. What if, you know, I brought Noel back in for some key episodes that are sort of like critical turning points, and we reviewed those together, and then I can fill in the gaps for some of the more sort of filler type episodes. Not that there's such a thing as a filler episode, but generally speaking. It was way more expensive for the site, and I was convinced they were not going to let us do it. And then I got the email where it's like, hey, yeah, you guys can go ahead and do it that way. And I'm like, okay, I'm committing to go to London. I'm committing to that trip. I can do it now. And literally that day, I got the job offer for the job I currently have. So it's like everything came into perspective that these reviews, I feel like, were these very meaningful moments. And then for Noel and I to be able to collaborate and go through all of that, I feel it really brought out so much of the collaborative function of this community, that when I was writing my reviews towards the end, they were in collaboration with everybody else who was writing them and writing about the show. And to be able to kind of be a part of that, and to add to that, and to bring in new viewers and existing viewers to kind of be a part of that community, I very much look back on that as one of my favorite assignments for the site, and certainly something that I wish we could have been able to continue, but didn't really. We kind of, the whole point was finishing off the reviews, and so I think we kind of just stopped there. And I keep getting direct messages from people where it's like, I'm loving the reviews, why did they stop? And I'm just like, that was the point of them, that's what they looked like. But I also feel like, in many ways, for that reason, season 3 holds a very special place in my heart because of those reviews. And because of the fact it was actually also the very first season of the show I reviewed back in 2007 when I started my personal blog. Meaning that in that circumstance, I've now reviewed that show twice, roughly 8 years apart. And I feel like, it's such an amazing artifact of my time online. And I feel like Lost very much holds that place. So for those reasons, definitely a project that I look back on. I'm glad it's proving useful for you, your listeners, and for anybody who's been reading.
And I'm about to be devastatingly bereft of them. But so, all right. So let's talk about this Charlie episode. This is... I think unequivocally the best Charlie episode, but that's like kind of a low
right.
bar. You know, for all my issues that I see with Charlie on these many rewatches, this episode still really, really works for me because I think maybe because of one of the later lines where he says, like, you know, my pathetic excuse of a life, mm-hmm. right? You know, and so you're just sort of like, oh, Charlie, you also agree you're a bad character. That's great. I love it. So maybe give me some broad strokes on why this episode is the one you want to talk about.
I think the thing for me about Charlie and what I think it sort of represents and kind of moves through is, for the record, I think it's just a really well-constructed episode of TV in terms of the way that it balances the sort of rising action of the story moment, which is that it starts off what we think is a setup episode, where it's very much like pieces moving into place. Okay, we have an idea of what the coming conflict is. We're going to get everything moved around. Characters' relationships are going to shift, etc. But then, like, everything gets rushed immediately as soon as Carl gets to the beach. And all of a sudden, chaos. So, like, the pace of it, I think, is just really interesting, pun unintended, in those circumstances, in those cases. But, like, the thing about the Charlie factor for me is that I feel like it says something about Lost's ability to, even when the arc of character has been a little bit messy, to when it needs to land something, when it needs to sort of hit a particular note to get where it needs to be, that something about the nature of the show, about the flashback structure, about how the writers sort of understood the humanity of the story and the nature of characterization, that when they needed to hit a beat like this, that when they needed to get to this point, they had every capacity to do so. That even if the arc was messy moving to this point, that doesn't preclude their ability to deliver something very emotional and very resonant and very purposeful. And I feel like for that reason, I think it speaks to a lot of the maybe misconceptions that come from Lost's struggle to balance being this broadcast drama while clearly being built for a cable model that wouldn't exist for another decade to a certain degree. And I feel like for that reason, Charlie is maybe, I think, the character most caught up in that. And as a result, the episode, I think, speaks a lot to that question.
It's funny because, you know, the episodes, the first flashback we get is with our pal Liam Pace. And, you know, if you're watching for the first time, maybe you start rolling your eyes because it feels like a very samey. Oh, Liam and Charlie are fighting. Always calling him baby brother. Always like stay in the band. Like, we've seen this so many times. I don't want to watch this. And then you just get the pure joy of that, like, that thing you do moment of like, oh my God, we're on the radio. And all of a sudden, like, you know, it really, really U-turns my feeling about that specific flashback. So I love that it starts with like almost a fake out of like, this is going to be a Charlie episode you recognize to one that you don't.
Well, and to be fair, it's like, it's clearly at this point, like everything after Jack's tattoo, it's very obvious to me that the writers are very aware of sort of flashback fatigue, right?
Yeah, right.
That there's very much an element happening here where it's like the audience is tired of seeing the same types of stories, and they know that and they're talking about it. And they're very sort of conscious, I think, of how that's playing out. And so for that reason, I do think there's an element of bait and switch, but even just the idea that like, that we think the flashbacks, that they're adding up to something. Right? That they're not just random scenes or a kind of ongoing narrative. They're used as sort of vignettes from different periods. It's just a different use of flashbacks, right?
Yeah.
It's not dramatically distinct. We talked about them being memories, which is new, but like, Yeah, you see the first one, you're just like, okay, what is this? And then you see it's a fun moment. It's like, oh, well, then now he's writing something down. Why is he writing it down? This sort of, it's a very small little mystery. It's ultimately not that significant to the larger picture, but just something to sort of be like, okay, what are we seeing? What does this say about Charlie? I think so many other times you'd see the first scene of a flashback and you're just sort of like, ugh. And I think it's not even so much that it's the worst thing. It's just like, it's predictable. We sort of know what these are meant to do. They're sort of the amount of revelation that's happening at this stage is just so small in the grand scheme of things that for that reason, now it's sort of like, this is a great example of a flashback that's still doing something that feels dynamic. And this far in its run, it's frankly amazing they were able to manage that, because you could tell that they themselves, I think, were running out of ideas, which I think speaks to some of lost broader macro problems that subsequent seasons were then forced to address. But I think the reality is, and this is sort of what it comes down to, it's like what I've been thinking a lot about as recently I was talking to Phil Iskove, who co-created Sleepy Hollow, and that came out in 2013. And like he and I, well, he was actually talking to my class, and one of the things we were talking about was the idea that at that moment in time, when it comes down to the question of like serial versus procedural, that show was trapped at a point where like a broadcast show couldn't really go full serial. It kind of had to keep its foot in the episodic realm to do standalone episodes, to go to syndication, to kind of play that out. So even a decade later, shows were still kind of trapped a little bit. But in 2004, you could have never made a version of Lost that was 12 episodes a season, that didn't have these sort of standalone stories that you couldn't theoretically like drop in on and try to understand. None of those factors were really part of this. It had to be a broadcast show in 2004. And the question for me was like, which characters benefited from that reality, that forced situation, and which characters ultimately were sort of impacted negatively by the same situation? And I think that's sort of a larger question. So I'm curious from your perspective, like which characters were better off because the show had to do so much story and tell so many flashbacks versus those that kind of got trapped in that same model?
I think Sawyer benefits from it because, you know, as much as we maybe feel like we know, like even episodes like the one where Sawyer's in prison and like, you know, finds out that Cassidy's pregnant, but like he's in prison and like it's just a great episode of Lost, but has nothing to do with the flashback. The flashback isn't great, but I think the popularity of Josh Holloway and the decision to like go deeper on his character, make him more than just sort of like, you know, the redneck foil. I think, you know, the further exploration of his past, I think that really benefits. And then Charlie, I think Charlie's, they just like, they blew right through their story right away with Charlie, and then they were like, whoops, we don't have more stories, and like we can figure out more places for Kate to run from, but we can't figure out more ways for Charlie to hit rock bottom, so we don't know.
What I think what you're speaking to there is like certain, so there's two benefits to my mind to the long the longevity storyline. One of them is certain characters clearly sort of grow into something different and grow with the audience and kind of are able to find themselves in a different role in the story by nature of just more time with them, smoothing off edges, finding new dynamics, etc. The other factor is if you have characters who are really foundationally tied to core issues of the show. So characters like Jack and Locke, I would argue, benefit from more time because there's more space to sort of test the idea of man of science, man of faith, the idea of their different perspectives, and each new thing that pops up, it's like, well, what Jack or Locke feels about that matters. Right? Because it's going to shape our understanding of them, our understanding of the dynamics of this group of people, etc. Whereas, like, with Charlie, each new thing that happened, who cares what Charlie thinks? Right?
Increasingly, who cares what Charlie thinks?
Right? And it's like, early on, it's like, we're getting to know these characters for the first time, we're sort of excited to get to know them more, and I think Charlie's initial arc, the drug addict storyline, the recovery, all of that makes sense and I think serves its own function. But once you resolve that story, you're right. They had nothing to replace it with. There wasn't a logical next step for him to go. And he was kind of comic relief, but also kind of not, because Hurley has that role and you kind of can't have two that function in that way. And because Hurley was kind of already there and they could flesh that out the drama side with the flashbacks and kind of contrast those, that's not available to Charlie. It doesn't work the same way. All of that tension, it was just sort of like, well, wait a minute. now it's like, what do we do with Charlie? What role does Charlie play in the story? And I feel like there's a bunch of those sort of mid-level supporting characters. I put Jin and Soon kind of in the same category, where it's just like, you feel like they lost the plot a bit at that stage and never quite figured out what they wanted to sort of manage with that. So you get things like the whole arc of Charlie and abducting Soon and all of this, which I feel like is a lot of where the audience frustration, the turning on Charlie, really kicks in. The dark Charlie, that's very much a byproduct of like, what else are we going to do? It's like in professional wrestling, this is, I swear this metaphor will make sense, but it's like, what do you do if somebody's like kind of, their arc's kind of over, they're kind of, people like them, but not too much. You turn them heel, right? You turn them into a bad guy, and then you have them act out in a certain way. And then once you're over with that, you abandon that story entirely, pretend it didn't happen, which is basically kind of what happens in this circumstance. But I feel like that's an inevitable result when you have a huge ensemble and you're trying to tell a story this way, is that there are pieces of that puzzle that are going to fit that long-term plan, and there's others that aren't, that you're going to use as problem solution kind of factors, where it's like, we have to have plot here, how do we create tension, how do we generate this, let's turn Charlie, let's turn Charlie into this different person. And it's like, it's a way to keep things moving and to keep the character engaged, but it fundamentally damages the arc of that structure in ways that the show then has to go on a full rehabilitation route, which has its benefits story-wise, as we see here, but ultimately still leaves, I think, a bad taste in the mouth, particularly if you don't have the memories of this holding on to that rewatch.
I think also the various characters where, you know, because the whole idea, the whole premise of the first season is like, you think you know someone? Well, guess what? They're this. It gotta look a little deeper than your first impression. So, like, the characters that are especially, like, twist heavy in their first season flashback, like, you, like, oh my God, Sun speaks English. Oh my God, Jin's not actually an asshole. You know, oh, Michael's actually a good dad, trying to be anyway. That sort of stuff. It, like, then where do you go if you've done the twist reveal? Jin is actually particularly problematic because they have to sort of like backslide him into being a dick every single time they do a flashback. And it's like, that's how progress works. You have backslides, but they're just like, seem like significant out of character episodes for Jin just to like get to a flashback for him. So,
right. I think you think you're right that when it comes to those characters in particular, thinking about that, it's like the contrast between flashback and island is useful up until the point where it complicates your ability to tell stories with that character in the present.
Right.
And I feel like there's like, contrast can be really productive, but I feel like they lost the productivity in some of these circumstances purely by nature of how far they had to bring them. And frankly, how much they didn't know what they were doing with those characters in the first season necessarily, because it's a TV show and that's how TV shows work.
And it's interesting when like plotting through, thinking about watching all the ways they sort of did, like, how do you solve a problem like Charlie? And like, with characters that weren't working for them, like Shannon and Boone, they're like, all right, bye. Right? But with Charlie, it's hard because Dominic Monaghan is, I would say their biggest name when season one launched, because he's hot off Lord of the Rings. I mean, like, I know that Matthew Fox had Party of Five, but like, I still think Dom Monaghan is the most famous person in the cast when the show starts. And he is, you know, in the pilot at least, he's like the third lead, maybe fourth lead, if you want to say John Locke. But in that pilot, you know, it's Kate and Jack and Charlie in the jungle.
Yep.
Like, that's mm-hmm. who Dominic Monaghan is sort of ostensibly supposed to be in this show. And then they're like, oh no, we don't know what to do with him. And so then, like, one of my favorite solutions that they came up with, like, dark Charlie paired with Sawyer, not a good look. Rehab Charlie paired with Locke, pretty good. Charlie and Claire, often toxic. Charlie and Mr. Echo, actually great. And it's really, it's too bad for many reasons that Echo left the show, but like, really too bad because like, that had been the place where they had decided to like grow Charlie as these like buddy men of faith sort of thing, acolyte sort of priest thing. And then Mr. Echo's gone so that they can't do that anymore, you know?
Right. And it's like, and all of this, again, is when you have a huge ensemble and you're basically like filling out C stories, which is basically where Charlie was for much of the seasons where he wasn't there. Because like you say, he starts out in the A and they immediately realize we don't really have much for him to do, and he's kind of comic relief, but also kind of not, because he has a dark arc to work with. Let's figure it out. And I think you're right. Like, they find a connection, find a story. They're brainstorming. Could this work? They start seeing dailies. Oh, that kind of works. We can play around with that. Echo's gone. What do we do now? All of that is like, I would never trade the version of Lost we have for the version of Lost that is like 12 episode seasons and very carefully plotted, and they've got all this time and going through all of this, because I think the mess of Lost is also a lot of where its charm often comes from. Just points of discovery, things they didn't realize were going to be as big a deal as they were. But it's like, to accept something like Sawyer's character growth, or to accept what happens with Ben and Michael Emerson, or with Juliet and these other characters who kind of get discovered as they're trying to find stories and solve problems, there's always going to be like the trade-off of that, right? Yeah. That there's, you can't have those moments of discovery and spontaneity without also having characters like Charlie, who sort of inevitably fall off a cliff at a certain stage in the story and have to sort of find their way back in a way that gets messy. And rewatching a show and writing about every episode, like you say, it's like, when we get to the big episodes, it's like, okay, this is like this pivotal moment in Lost. Let's put this into perspective. Let's go through this. But when I came to episodes like the previous Charlie episodes, I was just like, oh, right. This.
Right, yeah.
And it's always hard too, because like, I remember, so like with Lost, I watched it live and then rewatched it. But on my blog previously, back in like 2009-ish, I did a full, well, I did like a 5.5 season first time watch of Buffy.
Uh-huh.
And what was interesting about that for me is, again, there's another show, 22 episode seasons. There's some episodes that are real clunkers in there, some real arcs that kind of get dropped and lost and all these things. What was interesting there was that I was in the position of the new viewer, was getting people like preparing me for episodes.
Right.
Like, an episode would be coming up and they would just be like, oh man, you're just gonna have to plow through that one. Like, it's a real mess.
Yeah.
Like, it's gonna be a complete... And it was always interesting, because I'd get to it and I'm just like, well, it's not so bad. Like, it's a 22 episode season. These things happen. But I think sometimes we hold on to those as like, that's the dark mark. That's the moment that stands out. It's just, to me, a really complex thing about viewership and reception and first time. Like, it's, to me, that is all about Lost to me. Like, I love that about it. I will take that every day, but it definitely is not perfect. And I think we know that, and I don't think anyone's pretending otherwise, but I do think that cases like this are great reminders of that, that speak to it being of its time, a time that I think the next generation of viewers won't have as much patience for, as much context for. And
right.
So I feel like part of our job is to provide that context.
So you mentioned the urgency, the arrival of Carl urgency of this episode. And I already shouted out one of my favorite line readings, which is like, pathetic excuse of a life, or whatever it is that Charlie says.
Yeah.
But Carl's like, you know, pause, and then they're coming right now, and then
it's
act
so good.
Break. I rewound it like 3 times. I just love the way that actor delivers that line. It's like a musical almost, like he's about to burst into song, and then it's like the horns are like, meow, and then it's act out. So
it's also like the way Giacchino's score cuts out right after the first line, so it's like a pure beat of just like, they're coming. It's like, they're coming right now, and then the horns. Oh, it's, I will say, all the act breaks in this episode are so good.
Yeah.
In fact, when I wrote about it for the AV Club, like, my task, and unfortunately you have to sit through an ad for every single one of them now, but on the AV Club review that Noel and I wrote about this episode, which you can't read until you watch the finale, because we refused to write about it without talking about the finale, because we were mean that way, apparently. But when we did that, I was like, I'm going to take clips of each and every act break and I'm going to embed them so I can talk about them one by one, because each of them like is like, you can see what they're doing with Charlie's character. There are some moments like an act, and there's an act out on him and Hurley later on, but then this big action act out. And then earlier on, you have sort of more just like Desmond, like dropping the bomb on Charlie that he has to die and all these things. Like, all those little bits, it's like this, it's this growing escalation. And like, Lost act outs are always often super good, but like, this episode in particular, I think, is just very well calibrated for what it needs to do. And then of course you get to the very end of the episode, which is equally about this sort of like shocking moment of kind of pushing against expectation. Like, people often remember this as being, okay, it's about Charlie, it's about all of this, but it's also a great penultimate episode of a TV season.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it totally understands how to kind of lull you into a false sense of security, disrupt that, make you think you understand what's about to happen. And then disrupting it, but also providing such clear structure to what's about to take place. Like, I think you have a pretty clear sense about what is going to happen on the island in the finale when you leave this episode, while nonetheless still being uncertain about how that's going to play out. And I feel like that's right. A perfect, like, just, again, I always ask, like, think back if you had to wait a week to after watching this episode to then waiting for that finale. I feel like that would have been, that's just a reminder of like how much that was part of our experience and our relationship to the show of knowing we had to sit with this for a week. I think it's a well-constructed piece that way.
Yeah, we love parallel quests, which we've got like three
quests.
Yeah, it's great stuff. The last line reading I want to mention, and like to feed into a prompt for you is when Charlie finishes his list and the last line isn't like when I first met Claire, it's when I first met you. And then you realize that this is something that he's writing for Claire. And, you know, that's, you know, it really could have easily been Claire and he still wants to give it to Claire, but there's just something about the like the use of you there, the knowledge that this is like a document he was putting together for Claire. You know, so I want to ask you this. As bumpy as the Claire and Charlie stuff is, and it was really bumpy because, like, peanut butter is so cute, stealing her baby, really bad. So, like, okay. But Lost as a romance, and Damon Lindelof stuff in general as romantic television. I was wondering, like, what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, so I think the romance function, like, I was thinking about that if we're talking about like the long-term storytelling, it's like relationships are things that can be played out, the will they won't they factor, that's sort of a natural like long-term storytelling that broadcast shows really rely on, because you can have big moments that are really meaningful, but then you can put it on ice really easily because you just go to a won't they phase and you're just like, ah, we're in a won't they phase, you know, Jack and Kate are apart, oh, but they're back together now. And so you're like just playing around with those expectations. It gives you a lot of sort of pliability to how you tell a story. In the case of Charlie and Claire, yeah, like, I think the reality is that to try to tell a secondary love story on this show when you have such a clear central love triangle turned, like, love square, love rhombus situation once you throw in Lucia eventually, and then you just kind of, Juliet, like, you just start piecing things in. It's sort of like it was always going to feel kind of secondary. And when that was like charming and cute and kind of light and meant to distract from some of the like high stakes stuff, I think that that made a lot of sense. When you made that about high stakes, when you added the stakes to that relationship, it felt like another case of the show kind of being like, we need to find stakes somewhere. We need to stretch this out. We need to emphasize this. And it's Lost. Like, it's about these people trapped on an island. This island is trying to kill them on various levels. Like, it could never be entirely safe from that. But I do think, like you say, there's a whiplash factor.
Yeah.
And so, like, ultimately, like, to see the sort of romanticized version of their connection, to go back to the sort of first flashback and retelling the story and sort of getting to know them, the peanut butter and all this, when you frame it through that lens, I think that that's fine. That works. You're right that not every piece of it does, but I guess to some degree they're relying on the fact that our memories aren't that good and we just block out the stuff we don't like and there's a lot of show here and we just kind of focus in on that. And I definitely think that that's to the degree what I've done. Like, I wouldn't say they're my favorite couple on the show, but I would argue that, like, I have a very positive feeling about them, having not recently rewatched all those episodes again, that in the subsequent 5 years since I wrote those reviews, I've kind of been like, oh yeah, Charlie and Claire, that's so charming and wonderful, and I feel so generally positive about it. But, like, if you think about it and read about it and watch it, it's like, oh, well, wait a minute, actually, this is sort of messed up.
It's bad. It's like, I'm just sort of like, I thought it was so cute when I watched it before, and I'm like, how did I ever? And also, like, rewatching it now, season two is when it's really bad. And then in season three, they're mostly just like, Charlie and Claire are cute. And the only time she's mad at him is when he's like lying to her because he's trying to save her life. And that's like, or doesn't want her to know that he's going to die or whatever it is. You know what I mean? And so it feels like they made a real effort in season three to just be like, we're going to keep this nice and cute. And Claire has total amnesia, but the fact that he tried to steal her baby 2 weeks ago, and they're hoping the audience will as well. And so that's where we are.
I think what you sort of speak to that too is that the idea in that circumstance that Charlie seems to sort of understand that, like, if, in fact, like you say, that he's lived this horrible life and hasn't done all these things, that he wants to believe that he can do something good
right.
for her, for Aaron. And so the way in which he's writing this for her and the way in which he leaves the ring behind is sort of like, this is like the part of me that I want to be a part of this. All of that, I think, feels like a form of penance, right? It feels like, to some degree, even if the show is still hoping we forget why he's being... Like why he's like trying to make up for things and trying to rehabilitate himself. The fact that he is, I think, does help towards that more positive feeling.
Right. And as you say, like, usually it's a mistake to put large stakes on this relationship. But in this instance where it is the stake, these are the stakes for Charlie. According to, I love when Desmond like reconfigures his understanding of his powers, and he's like, now my powers are like an if then. If this doesn't happen, then this doesn't happen. And I'm like, So according to Desmond, if Charlie doesn't flip the switch and drown, whatever that means, then Claire and Aaron won't get off the island. So this is why Charlie is doing this. He's like, I'm doing this to save Claire and Aaron, my family, that I've created here. And I do like that the episode, just to like give you that extra dose of like heroism for Charlie, like that Desmond like gives him an out, and Charlie's like, it's not just like, it's a very active decision for Charlie.
Right. I do think that's really critical, that it's not just like, I guess I got to do this. I also think because like they're trying to reframe Charlie as a hero here. I think that's critical. And I think they do understand that he wasn't a hero for an extended period of time and had lost track of that. And so I think the fact that he takes action and ownership, and I think also the idea that I think it's just also not just I'm making a sacrifice for everybody. I'm making a sacrifice specifically so Claire and Aaron can get off the island.
Right.
That is the specific goal. Again, you want one's life to have purpose, right?
Yeah.
To have done something
What's
meaningful.
My legacy? Yeah.
Right. And I think, and I think that's why like that little conversation, that they have with Naomi, when it's just sort of like that idea that when he was off the island, right, that when when he died, allegedly, right, that Driveshaft had the greatest hits record, that his legacy has sort of lived on, that there's a version of Charlie would have been like, well, that's my legacy. Right? My music, like, I was famous and fine, whatever happens, happens. But I think it's the idea that he's choosing a legacy that's about personal impact, that's about meaning something more than being a rock star.
Yeah.
I do think that is sort of part, it's interesting, that hearing himself on the radio is the number five thing on his list and not the number one or the number two.
Claire's number one. Yeah.
I think is also a reordering of his understanding of his priorities in a way that does feel, again, very much like growth that doesn't really do much about the whole, kidnapping people situation during the Dark Charlie era, but does, I think, do a lot to sort of suggest the kind of longitudinal growth that you want from a character in a serial like this, and that ultimately, I think, plays off.
So now is the time on the podcast where we love to thank our Patreon subscribers. We got a bunch of new subscribers. Like, I'm just astonished every time we open the thing and there are new people here. So thank you. I mean, what else are we doing in a pandemic, I guess, except watching Lost together? So I want to thank some newcomers, including Taylor Granger, or maybe Gringer, Katie Rinaldi, Marissa Zane, Ben Brown, Otto Nim, Logan Wagner or Wagner, Kevin Mullaney, Carol Blaine, Monica Rickman, Christopher Woodside, Natalie Smith, Ruby Durham, Tanya Shrum, Dennis Ramirez, Rebels, Alyssa Scott, Kwang Yu Liu, Liz Major, Brian Morosky, and Randy Blash. Thank you guys so much.
And I would like to add to that thanks Brittany Whimsy Riot, Sam Cohen, Kale Whitney, Amber Vickers, Shosav Odale, Patricia Delaney, Tim Wiseman, Carrie King, Lauren Bree, Christopher Bates, Steph Deal, Aubrey Iyer, Elise Abschutz, Josh Brown, Victoria Stout, Kathy Schauberg, Lindsay Romaine, Grace Brown, A. Will, and Ellen Rabin. Thank you guys very much.
And I would like to thank the following lovely human beings, including Katie Truchon, Liz Roller, Rosie O, Billy Bosky, James Cooper, John Lillystrom, Kitsune Lane, yeah, okay, all right, haven't had that one in a while, Samantha O'Leary, Kevin Costello, Patrick Kelly, Patrick McCracken, Angela Travis, C.A. Sachs, Kurt Klein, Matthew Keane, Karen Frost Arnold, Blake Bell, Ali Oman, Brad Mashenko, and Vanessa Marshall. Thank you all. So many of those names I continue to just recognize because y'all have been around a while.
And we are back for the storm. Can't have a Locke antagonist check-in, because as far as the colonies know, he's dead in a pit. And we do it through the entire episode without talking about, like, the fact this is a great episode to, like, lead up to Charlie's death. So much so that when I think about the end of the third season, this episode bleeds right into Through the Looking Glass for me. It's a three-parter.
It feels like Looking Glass Part 1 should be, you know. I agree.
Mm-hmm.
But I also like the idea of
penultimate. I mean, just a great setup for
so good.
All of the chaos that is about to happen.
And it's all on island chaos. I don't think they've really tipped their hands to what's about to happen at the end of next week's episode, and as far as our flashback structure. But this is like a great squeezing the last good idea out of the flashback structure before you bow out.
My, I don't want to steal the thunder of the conversation with Miles, but we already had it, so this is me just piggybacking off of it. Miles, I had some quibbles with Charlie's list, and Miles had some very smart points about why what is on there is on there, including like ending with the personal versus like the, I think in a different, and when we first met Charlie, probably like hearing himself on the radio would have been his number one,
mm-hmm.
but it's his number five because he's grown as a person in terms of what he values. But I had some ideas for some other things that I felt like should be on the list. The only thing that I mentioned to Miles was Charlie getting the piano from his mom. His mom is the good parent. And we are like basically these are moments we've already seen. And so they can't like do it again. But like if I were to like Monday morning quarterback Charlie's list and I were the writers, I would have put 10 things on the list. And like you didn't have to show us a flashback for each one, but like maybe show us like, you know, when mom gave me the piano, you know what I mean? That would have been on his list for sure. Not the time dad helped me jump into a pool because we need it here for narrative purposes so I can say that
I mean, then 10's too much, you know, because at some point down at like 9, given the flashbacks we've seen, it's like the one time I didn't do heroin. It's like, no. Oh, top 10.
There are some other things like the time I brought you peanut butter or
the time right before what's her name found out that I was lying.
Yeah, the time I got away with killing Joanna.
I've killed two people on this island at least.
The time
Claire forgave me for stealing the baby.
Yeah. The time I baptized the baby.
The time I started a van with Hurley and went for like a fantastic joyride. You know what I mean? So like, I don't know. Maybe 8, because you got to have mom and the piano not being on there is a real bummer because dad's a bad dad. Miles's point, which I thought was good, was that he's dug up a good memory about the bad parent, like the one good memory about his bad parent or something like that. And sometimes those are stronger than all the good memories about the good parent. And I'm like, yeah, that makes sense to me. So. But anyway, I mean, I know why all of those things are there. They're there for plot reasons, but I'm just like, mom and the piano got real short shrifted on the list. So I don't know.
But then we'd have to think about him stealing a baby. They can't reference that episode. Otherwise, we're like, wait, he tried to steal that baby. Now he can just hug it whenever he wants.
Now he can just drop a choking hazard into its crib.
Okay. Yeah. Tell him he loves it. They're like a weird, weird baby. all right, we have some emails here in the storm. Are they off this? Should we drill down a little bit more on greatest hits? I feel like
No, Jason's email is about Dom Monaghan. Oh, Jason. No, it's Joseph. Joseph's email is about Dom Monaghan.
Oh, sweet.
Longtime listener, first time writer. I want to chime in on Greatest Hits and Through the Looking Glass to say that I think they think part of the reason everyone remembers Charlie so fondly is that his swan song is so impeccable. These two episodes are one of Lost's best back-to-back pairings, and Monaghan is so good in both. Charlie gets a lot to do in both episodes, and I find basically everything he does when he's being beaten up to be simply endearing. Charlie's so charming, and his final moments are so moving that it's easy to forget how frustrating his presence has been on the show. It's the same problem that Lost faced more generally. People only remember the ending and forget about all the stuff before it. Anyway, love the show. Thanks, Joe. So I think that's a good point. Like, a bunch of our, I've been like really, as I've mentioned before here in the store, I've been really worried that our commies wouldn't give a shit about Charlie. But at least from the social experiment of our live watch last weekend, this episode was really emotionally effective for a lot of our calm listener, first time watchers who didn't care for Charlie. And they were like crying in this episode anyway. And I'm like, yes,
yeah,
work your manipulative magic. So,
well, yeah, and I think that a lot of the problems that we've talked about with Charlie they're not really about Dom Monaghan's performance.
Like, no,
his performance has been solid throughout. It's just sort of the way the show uses him. And this feels like the first time they really hit it, where it's like they write the character extremely well and he delivers the great performance with tons of subtlety. And, you know, in the next episode, we're going to get some bigger stuff from him. But it's what makes the Charlie thing sad, because it feels like right at the end, they figure it out. Like, they figure out how to get the most out of that character in, like, these last 3 hours of season 3, and then he's gone.
But I don't think necessarily the translation of that is that, they figured him out, so he, you know, if they just kept going on this vein, it would have been better. Because, like, sure, the reason it works is because the stakes are what they are. You know what I mean? Yeah. That we know the reason why he's doing all this stuff. And I think if they hadn't...
If they hadn't killed him,
it would have... People would have been really mad.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's complicated.
Well, I mean, it would have been, you know, like, this episode is a beautiful way to say goodbye to a character that you know that you're killing, and so I think it would have felt weird had they not gone beyond it. But that being said, I think Neil's sort of right in the sense they stumbled across the way to write Charlie, which is that the character was saddled with two stereotypes that were pretty much you could only play so much range within them, which is like drug addict rock star and like a lapsed devoted Catholic who has like guilt about that. And they did those and to varying success, and then every time they would return to that, I would like kind of shirk back. It's like, surely there's more to this man than these two things. And that this episode is like, here's a whole bunch of things that don't involve either the two things that were the only two things you defined Charlie by. So just like that refreshingness is allowing him to like break out of his stereotype. I'm not sure if they necessarily solved Charlie, to more to Joanna's point, in the sense that this is so refreshing because it like works in context and because it's not what it was in the past. I don't know if I want to follow down, you know, Charlie thinks he's a hero because he stopped an assault, and then, you know, like,
right,
thinks he's a Manchester Batman for a year of his life that we didn't see. Like, I don't know how that develops in a more interesting way. I kind of like going out on top. But great performance for sure. And then,
I mean, we'll talk about this obviously next week, but he is really good in Through the Looking Glass. He's just so like, because Charlie's just like, whatever, I'm gonna die. He's just so like fucking devil may care down in the Looking Glass station. It's pretty, because Charlie's been so angry and serious and like all this sort of stuff. And when you let Dom be more of like fucking Mary from Lord of the Rings, it's better. Surprise, surprise. That thing he was famous for doing, he's good at.
Well, it's also interesting that like this is the first death, I think, on the rewatch where it's like the show knows it's coming and it gets to take its time into it. I think all the other deaths that we've come across have just been like, oh, Boone's not working out, or like, oh, the Tailies, you know, it's not happening, or like Adewale wants out the show, or like mysterious circumstances around why Libby was shot that we discussed on Two for the Road. But this one, like, they really got to build up to saying goodbye to a character in their way, and it shows that they're good when knowing what they're doing. Speaking of building up, Joanna, I notice you have a whole bunch of bullet points here that I'm guessing are payoff points.
Well, I mean, we'll talk about, like, all the payoff points. Okay, I do want to tell people that, like, off air between our Commodore Storm section, we started calling Charlie Shappy because the Sharpie has, like, such a payoff next week. So Shappy. But anyway, Charlie the Sharpie is one thing, and we could talk about that more. But a bunch of our first-time watchers were like, why did Charlie have to, like, knock Desmond out with a paddle and leave him, like, defenseless floating on the ocean to get, like, sunburn is the least of his worries, but, like, leave him really, like, vulnerable out on the ocean like that. And my answer to you is the plot needs Desmond to be locked out for a while so that he can rush in and save Charlie in the nick of time, you know, before he ultimately can't save Charlie. But, like, yeah, it's plot reasons, you know. Mm-hmm. I agree. It seems like an aggressive thing to do, but plot reasons. And then also, like, why is Rousseau helping them you know, with what they're with this current plan? Because Rousseau's attitude so thus far had been like, I don't get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because we need her to be in place for the Alex Rousseau reunion. Mm-hmm. That's happening next
week. Also, this is something they kind of set up, right? Because didn't Kate tell her?
Yeah,
Kate told her. Yeah, and she saw. Yeah. Didn't she see her? Oh no, she hasn't seen her yet.
Maybe
I can't remember when they go to the other camp.
Yeah, I mean, so there's plot, like, reasons behind why Rousseau, why they chose Rousseau for this, but as well, which I like. It ties in nicely.
She's still been pretty hands off, even with the knowledge that Alex is mm-hmm. over there and stuff like that.
The
like,
thing,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the thing I'll agree with you with is that it's weird that Jack convinced her to do this. Saeed, definitely. Kate, maybe. Jack, absolutely not.
Hurley, definitely.
Hurley could, yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Like, I'm like, how dare you try to take over sight of Rousseau Whisperer from Saeed? That is his, you know.
Yeah, that's what Kate Rousseau does.
Like, yeah.
They have one history.
It is curious because I think, and folks mentioned this in the live watch as well, like, this idea that Jack is just like, hey, we're going to keep your gun to Rousseau. And it's like, have you met Rousseau? She doesn't give up her gun very easily.
That's true.
Definitely not to Jack. So it just, it feels like she becomes this, like, you know, sort of subservient to Jack's plan. But
yeah, it just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right because she'd be like, so? And Jack's like, they're going to kill all of us. She's like, cool, I'll be in the jungle.
She's like, cool.
You know?
You weren't here before, and I was fine.
So I don't really know what your point is. Yeah. And then Hurley looking for something heroic to do is another thing, right? Like, he's like, you know, I'm tired. I don't want to trek. I'm tired of being just like, you know, shoveled from one spot to the next. I want to have a big hero moment. I want to do something. I'm useful. I'm A-team. Damn it. So, of course, Hurley gets a big heroic moment next week. So, which pays off. Which is possibly the best pre-plant payoff of the VW van. So,
so we needed a van.
Yeah.
And they were right.
Yeah, okay.
We went all the way through Roger Workman to get a heroic Hurley moment. Ooh, it's hard to just say that spontaneously off the top of your head.
Shappy. All right, I have one final issue, and this comes from the last time I watched these episodes, which was Greatest Hits and Through the Looking Glass back-to-back. So Charlie is the weight belt and it's like time is of the essence and he has to get down and oh my God, blah, blah, blah. When Desmond goes down later, groggy from having been concussed, he uses the cable to pull himself down. And I'm like, why didn't Charlie use the cable to pull himself down? And then I think I also have questions about the cable and getting yourself back up. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like it would be faster to use the cable to get yourself back up.
To follow the cable?
Yeah. Right?
Instead of floating
and swimming?
I don't know.
Isn't that why you need the weight belt? I don't understand how, I've not been in the ocean a lot in my life, so I don't understand how salt water works as opposed to the water where I grew up, which was just like garbage and water.
Mm-hmm.
Lake Erie.
We call it sewage.
I mean, it caught on fire once. So, what are you gonna do?
I think that you could swim up faster than you could climb up the rope if you knew, like, what you were doing. You know, make cups out of your hands, not be wearing jeans, like, know how to scissor kick. But just in terms of your layman, yeah, like, pulling, using your upper body strength to pull up the rope faster is probably better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the real inconsistent cable usage is my observation for the next couple episodes. We will see.
Like, why aren't you guys using the cable? I'm wondering is if it's
use
like
the cable, real choppy.
If it's
Chappy.
Chappy.
Chappy, use the cable.
Oh, so it's gonna turn into Chappy jokes real fast and no one's gonna know how it got there. Like if it's deep enough, if it's that shallow enough down to, like, you know, be able to dive basically with the belts, he's basically doing like crab diving from like that James Bond movie we watched, Dr. No. Couldn't you like make a diving bell and like breathe all the way to the bottom?
And a butterfly?
You could.
Well, I mean,
although is that cable, what does that cable do? Is it electrical?
Well, maybe, but just like even if you took a bucket, put it over your head, and jumped down, you could take a spare tarp, right, and put it around your head and jump down. And as long as you had enough rocks to pull yourself down, you would keep air in the tarp.
I would never have known that you could make one could make a diving bell out of some tarps.
Mm-hmm. Well,
today I learned.
I'm sure it'd be difficult.
Fuselage or something, some leftover wreckage that apparently they're still working on.
Yeah,
90 days.
Let me have them strip the wreckage. I'm like, what are you even doing every single day, guys, if not stripping the entirety of the wreckage?
They built the kitchen, and then they used the kitchen, and then for a while they had a shower, and that blew up.
Barbecues. I don't know. It was a busy time.
Paolo had to do some golfing. Remember Nikki and Paolo? Okay.
Bernard gave everybody tooth checkups throughout season 3.
Nice. Yeah, so I did want to talk about that really quickly. The miracle of Rose and Bernard, that we could not see Bernard all season and still be immediately invested in Rose and Bernard's return, right? Mm-hmm. And they're gonna fake out kill Jin and Bernard next week, which is one of the more annoying things that they do. That's okay, because like there's a bunch of fake out deaths next week, but then like Charlie actually dies, so it balances out. But, you know, we have to care a lot about whether or not Bernard survives. And we do, because of one knot tying and one skeet shooting scene. It's not skeet shooting. Target practice, whatever you want to call it. Anyway. Also, shout out to Saeed looking at Bernard being kind of like, he's very good. Saeed was thinking when he was looking at Bernard.
Saeed quietly forming his own team in his mind for when he has to break off. Being like, oh, Bernard, maybe.
When he Bernard has to kill Jack. Bernard, got it. Sawyer is barely in this episode, by the way, which is interesting. Like, he protects Carl, and that's about it. I mean, he'll have more to do, but like...
It's like, hey, that's my buddy Carl.
Yeah, that's it. And Kate's like, well, here we go again. That's about it for Kate.
Although, you know, Kate's arms make a strong showing in the scene, like in the scene where they're like interrogating... Or no, that in the scene where Jack's giving them their plan, Kate's, you know, crossed arms, she's got the guns out. You know, they say enough sometimes.
She's like, "You're gonna need these. You mm-hmm. need these for your plan.
Are you gonna?
How many guns do we have
with this gun show? Or?
Yeah, how many guns do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I believe."
Oh,
Chappy,
right. Chappy. Jump, Chappy. Oh, God, that's not even... I'm now murdering the inside.
Jump into the water, Chappy.
Jump, Chappy. All right, Neil. I mean, I feel like we've been saying it a lot, but what happens on Lost next week?
Oh, we're going through the Looking Glass, parts 1 and 2, which I'm somehow excited to say is a Jack episode. When's the last time we had a Jack episode?
Oh, I think we learned some stuff about his tattoo.
Stranger in a Strange Land.
Stranger that walked among us.
While. And, you know, we're going to jump right from the Best Charlie episode to at least the Best Jack episode yet.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
At the end of next week's podcast, everybody will know why it's so hard to do a 3 seasons of a Lost Rewatch podcast and not promote yourself constantly if we have to go back. We tried.
Did did you hear in the review, I didn't correct it on purpose, but that the person who wrote the review misidentified that quote as being said by Locke because they've just heard it in the intro to the podcast. They said, parentheses, Locke voice, we have to go back.
Okay, good.
That's what it sounds like.
I made a note to actually go back and listen to that to make sure I didn't need to bleep it later. So now I'm going to write down intentional.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, good.
I thought that was cute. Well, yeah, I mean, like, people have been like, when we first started, a bunch of people were like, you've got to go back in the opening of the podcast. That's a spoiler. But it's like, without the context.
It's just about a rewatch. Yeah, it's just like we have to watch that again.
When it hits, it's gonna mean something to them. But it's funny because like it reminds me of at the end of Game of Thrones when there's that like Bran and Littlefinger scene about chaos is in a pit, chaos is a ladder or whatever. And like the average watcher was like, "What are they talking about?" And all the Storm of Spoilers listeners were like, "Oh shit."
It's the chaos is a ladder.
Oh, it's the most famous speech in all of Game of Thrones. Shoppy. I'm excited.
Yeah. And then I have to figure out what quotes to put in season 4 about the freaking freighter and not put the word constant in there. I'll figure it out. Until next week, when we'll be talking about the Listening Gas Parts 1 and 2 and wrapping up Season 3 of Lost, where can people find more of your work around the internet? Let's start this week with Neil Miller.
Well, you can always get me over at Film School Rejects. You can get me on Twitter, at Rejects, at One Perfect Shot. You can get me on this podcast. That's where I do most of my best work, in my opinion. Follow us on the Twitter, at Storm Podcast.
And Joanna Robinson.
Oh, you can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I am currently doing Little Gold Men, where I interviewed Jesse Buckley, and still watching, where we're talking about the Luca Guadagnino show, We Are Who We Are, over on Vanity Fair. So check out those things. Yeah.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. Stay off Twitter, and I'll be here telling you to not fall down next week.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com.